The opinions expressed on Night Call do not necessarily represent the views of WRIF, its management, or its sponsors. So that goes triple for PeterWerbe.com. PeterWerbe.com. Now, it hasn't been changed for 2 weeks. I've been away for 2 weeks. And it's funny, right when you think one of the most important news stories that's occurred in a long time is going to be what's everyone's talking about, Bush's speech about Iraq. Remember, people going, what was that? Oh, yeah, a couple of weeks ago. Supreme Court Justice Sandra Day O'Connor resigning, and then what kind of right-wing freak is Bush going to try to shove down the throats of the American people? But all of that, of course, becomes trumped by what happened in London. But let me back up a bit. I took the opportunity, since I didn't have to work last weekend, to get some time away. And I mean, I was away. There, where I was, there was no... Can you imagine this? Can you imagine how deprived I was? Or on the other hand, can you imagine how I was roughing it? No email contact for a whole week. No cell phone reception for a whole week. Can you imagine that in this day and age? Well, there I was, and I loved it. In fact, when I finally got back, and I'm not going to tell you where. Here's why. I don't mean to be rude or anything like that. Actually, I do mean to be secretive. And by the way, if you're ringing now, please be patient, and Jay Hudson, our producer and phone screener, will get to it. Here, big parentheses in the big parentheses that I'm always doing. I know it's called ADD, but I can't help it. That's why I have this job. Congratulations, Jay Hudson. He produced and announced the entirety of Motor City Riffs, our fine local music show, where you hear some of these bands that you're first going to hear here on Motor City Riffs on WRIF. And one of these days, like so many Detroit bands for the last 30 or 40 years, you're going to be hearing about all over the country and all over the world. Anyways, congratulations, Jay. Let's see. Okay, so I'm in the secret spot. So why am I calling it secret? Well, partly it's, you know, personal space and what have you, but also it's a space where people don't even want people to come. Too many people there already, so they would get really angry. And this is not where it is, by the way, but I forgot. I wanted to give a shout-out to a new listener, actually an old friend, Eddie, down in Eureka Springs, Arkansas, listening on the Internet, proprietor of a fine establishment in Eureka Springs, Luigi's Italian Restaurant. And so if you're by that little town, which is not so little anymore, stop by Luigi's and tell Eddie that Peter said hello. All right. So everything's moving pretty slowly in this isolated vacation spot. So I learned about the London bombings the next day. I didn't even hear about it the same day. We got news. Not like, you know, we were up on the Arctic Circle. Well, everywhere. In the Arctic Circle, you still get news. Well, we got the news. And, you know, maybe I could even, and I'd like to hear your impressions of this, and we're going to get the kind of the bigger picture of it. What are we in? What kind of era are we in? You know, our parents or grandparents, when World War II, that announced itself pretty dramatically, Pearl Harbor. And you could say, well, same thing with September 11th. But we thought this was going to be over pretty rapidly. It was the greatest country in the world, as it's often defined, the most powerful country in the world, no dispute about that. And we were cast into that kind of helpless giant status by September 11th, but then roaring back into Afghanistan and then into Iraq, both to find the perpetrators. Of course, Iraq had derailed that and allowed the perpetrator, who Osama bin Laden, now Osama bin Forgotten, of course, to completely get away, and instead off to this fool's mission in Iraq. And mission accomplished. Well, you know, you just see now they do that, people kind of like wiping their hands off, that's done. Except now we're in the endless war, and to some extent, Bush, Cheney, et al. Had told us that. This could go on for generations. And it strikes me, particularly given the politics of the terrorists, right-wing fundamentalists, and given the politics of the people in the Bush administration, right-wing fundamentalists, we're in the crossfire, the ordinary people. We got to figure out how to get out of the crosshairs, how to stop the world from solving its problems through what we saw all through the 20th century, with tens of millions of people dead. I mean, maybe we should be thankful. So far, there hasn't been any atomic weapons launched. So far, there hasn't been any mass bombings of cities. I mean, we're horrified when, and rightly so, that we should be. The 50 people die. But at places like Dresden and Rotterdam and Guernica and all these other cities like that, Tokyo, people died in the hundreds of thousands. So maybe there is some advance, but still, too many innocent people dying. Too many people caught in the crossfire of men with big ideas, how they're going to change the world. They have world transformative ideas. World transformative ideas. I've got an idea. And I do. I got a lot of ideas. I try to convince you all the time. Every Sunday, I try to convince you of my ideas. And you frequently do the same with me. I see a lot of you have already called 313-298-WRIF. And we talk about every subject under the sun. And I really want to convince you. Yeah? But there are certain people that take it all a step further. They're going to force people to accept their ideas, either simply by the law. I mean, now, there's certain laws that we want. I mean, I don't want people going 50 miles an hour down my street, although they do. And I don't want people to be able to murder people or break into houses or, you know, all the stuff that that doesn't make for a good neighbor, peaceful community. But there's other stuff that there's big disagreement about. But you still have these people that want to take their ideas and have the political state force them upon everyone else. These are the dangerous people. And at a certain point, when they really can't have their way, they turn to violence. Now, I'm not just talking about the Muslim extremists. I'm talking about Bush. I'm talking about these right-wingers that are always trying to get these constitutional amendments passed and take their view of biology and make it the rest of our view, all of that stuff. Force their religion down our throat. I mean, they just can't live their lives. They can't just accept that maybe other people don't agree with them. And this is, I don't know, I mean, this is wide, this is, maybe I'm speaking in too general terms, because some of this stuff that goes on can't be allowed to go on. I mean, you can't allow some of the assault on the environment to go on. It's not like it's somebody else's opinion. It's not like Bush's friends, the polluters, it's their opinion that they shouldn't have to put on pollution controls. I mean, that they don't have the right to that opinion because it's not an opinion. Then it becomes action. Then it affects other people. Then it's like murder. In fact, it is. These corporations that are polluting our world are murdering people. I mean, the fact that there are so many cancers, asthma, all this stuff. If these corporations that run these polluting facilities, whether it's energy production or just factories or whatever, refineries, they should be forced to have zero emissions. Anything less than that is murder for profit. Murder Incorporated, essentially. Now, I'm getting really far afield. Let's talk a little about just the London bombing. And we can talk about the G8 conference where they're going to give aid to Africa, this impoverished, war-torn continent. It's been the object of Western-induced misery for the last 150 years or so. Maybe a little parable. You know, parables, they often are religious, but they're stories with a moral object to them. I used to live in Highland Park. Very poor neighborhood. And, for those of you not in the Detroit area, it's very odd. It's Highland Park's a suburb that's completely surrounded by the city. Never was annexed. There's another one, too, Hamtramck. Hamtramck's like working class and very hip. A lot of very cool bars, restaurants, and all. Highland Park, unfortunately, even though there's really good people in there trying to make something of the city, it's been pretty hammered economically. And my wife and I lived there, and we got broken into. And I can't begin to tell you the fear and rage, mostly fear in her, mostly rage in me. I thought, this can't happen again. So, I kind of talked to the cops, and, we said, anytime you want, call us. We'll put an extra patrol around. I don't know if they ever did. talked to the neighbors and said, hey, we got to look out for each other. And we hear anything suspicious, we got to call the cops and what have you. Put some bars up on the windows and did any number of other things. Anything that you'd want to do. First and foremost that you want to do is to make your house safe. You can see that in either very specific terms or obviously, since it's a parable, in general terms about our community or the whole society that we live in. And sure as hell, yeah, they found a way, broke in again, and then I bought a gun. Said, hey, anybody's going to come in here? Of course, I can't take the chance of having them harm me or mine. Fortunately, never came to that, and my wife, with good sense, and given that we had both the race and class privilege to choose where we could live, we moved out. So now we don't, yeah, guns in a gun bag, I don't know where the hell it is, up in my attic and what have you. But the point being here, no matter what I did, external circumstances meant that this was going to happen over and over again. Now, we lived in a community that was probably about 90% African American. And 95 or 99% of those people wanted the same thing that I did and my wife did. That is to live peacefully, to be good neighbors, to be good friends, to live our lives. And not have to worry about maybe that 5% of the population between 14 and 35 that was committed to criminality. Now, why do you have criminality? Well, you have bad people, real bad people. And most of those bad people seem to wind up in poor areas. Gee, could there be any connection? Could there be any connection? People are always doing these psychological studies of the criminals. You know, what makes these people tick? Well, the criminals that are out in the wealthy sections, Birmingham, West Bloomfield, Grosse Pointe, and what have you, I mean, they commit crimes, but they're what they call white-collar crimes. They're people that, there was an old Woody Guthrie song, said in this song called Pretty Boy Floyd, which has a lot of great lyrics, but one of his lines is, some men will rob you with a six-gun, others with a fountain pen. Well, we know out in the wealthy areas, they're robbing people with a fountain pen, either directly, yeah, white collar crime, or indirectly, just through the whole nature of an exploitative system. But in Highland Park, they don't use a fountain pen. Actually, there are stick ups and stuff like that, but these were breaking and entering. Point being, there was no way. One other point. And me, and them accurately perceiving us as being in a class different from them. And having more money and more privilege, both based on race and on class, this would be a good target to break in, good target to break into. They also broke in, since there wasn't that many white people there, they also broke into black people's homes as well. So it wasn't that they just picked on us because we were white, but they probably figured we'd have better stuff. Actually, we were such hippies that we probably had a lot less. In fact, the second time, they didn't even get anything. It wasn't anything really to get. So if you maintain the conditions that create crime, no matter how much police work, how much neighborhood security, no matter how much armaments, no matter how much diligence you have towards the situation you're in, somebody's going to get through that because they're bound and determined. Hello, do we have a parable here? Obviously, yes, because this worldwide war on terror is going terrible. It's creating the exact opposite of what it claimed it was going to do, to eliminate the people of the type that launched this hideous crime against civilians on September 11th, 2001, that did things like the bombings in Bali, the bombings in Madrid, and the bombing on Thursday in London. There is an article here, MSNBC is the source of it. It says, experts fear endless terror war. Analysts say Al-Qaeda is mutating into global insurgency. I mean, maybe we shouldn't even talk about this. I mean, this is so frightening that frightening. You know, people during World War II, I was asking some people that fought in World War II, I said, did you think the United States was going to win for sure? And they said, well, no, not at first. The tide began to turn 1943 and certainly by 1944. But in 1942, they're worried. They thought the Japanese could actually invade the United States, Western United States. Nazis could be victorious in Europe. But this, we don't know where or when a strike is going to be made. It's pretty clear that the people doing this see this as a war. They see this as a war against the West that, for again, for in the case of the Middle East, for a couple of hundred years, has intervened in an extraordinarily negative and exploitative way in the Middle East. They're fighting back. Well, we say, geez, what terrible means. And for sure. I mean, think about the people in Spain. I forgot what the percentage of people against the war, against Spain entering, sending troops to Iraq to base, back Bush's war. They had a right-wing conservative government, pal of Bush's. They sent over troops, and there was an election. Remember, a couple of days after the Madrid bombing, and they voted out the conservative guy, realizing because of all the Spanish people were against it. So when this bomb blew off in the subways in Madrid, these were probably the vast majority of people killed were people that were against the war. Same thing in England. Majority of people there against Blair's war and Blair's being involved in the whole nest of lies that Bush perpetrated in order to justify a war. So they wind up killing people that think, yeah, British ought to take their troops out of the Middle East as well. But here, this article, experts fear endless terror war. New York and Washington, Bali, Riyadh, Istanbul, Madrid, and now London. When will it end? Where will it all lead? The experts aren't encouraged. One prominent terrorism researcher sees the prospect of endless wars adds the man who tracked Osama bin Laden for the CIA. I don't think it's even started yet. That's pretty scary. They got crude bombs. We hear kind of scarier stuff as well. An Associated Press survey of longtime students of international terrorism finds them ever more convinced in the aftermath of London's Bloody Thursday that the world has entered a long siege in a new kind of war. They believe that Al-Qaeda is mutating into a global insurgency, a possible prototype for other 21st century movements, technologically astute, almost leaderless, and the way out is far from clear. In fact, says Michael Scherer, I'm going to say his name like this. I've seen this, you may know, I've never heard the name pronounced, S-C-H-E-U-E-R, Michael Scherer. I do know that he was ex-CIA analyst, and he was the guy leading for almost 10 years the anti-Osama bin Laden efforts for the United States government. And he says, rather than moving toward solution, the United States took a big step backwards by invading Iraq. Now he says we're at a point where jihad is self-sustaining, where Islamic holy warriors in Iraq fight America with or without allegiance to Al-Qaeda's bin Laden. The statistics of the RAND Corporation database shows the impact of violence in Iraq. The 5,362 deaths from terrorism worldwide between March 2004 and March 2005 were almost double the total for the same 12-month period before the 2003 U.S. invasion. So in other words, things have doubled. More people die because of terrorism since the United States has invaded and occupied Iraq. I mean, their logic is, hey, they're bombing us. At a minimum, they've killed 20,000 Iraqi civilians, mostly women and children, a maximum 100,000. So they're pasting us back. Pretty ugly on both sides, I'd say. It says the movement's evolution has given rise to a virtual network that is extremely adaptable. That's what one man says. It says they're switching to softer targets of mass transit. Bruce Hoffman, the veteran RAND Corporation specialist who fears an endless war, dismisses talk of Al-Qaeda's back having been broken by the capture of some leaders, and that's not even important anymore. What should be broken, he says, the cycle of terrorist recruitment through the generations. Here you come to the main challenge. And he says he and most of the other half dozen experts said the world's richer powers must address underlying causes, lessen the appeal of radicalism by improving economies, political rights, and education in Iraq and Muslim countries. Here's, this is what we're getting back to the Highland Park analogy. Talking about if you have the context of war, people are going to respond. If you invade their country, if you support who they see as their enemy, if you support the worst dictators, I'm talking about us now, the United States, the worst dictators in the region, in Saudi Arabia, in Egypt, in the Gulf Emirates, well, guess what? They say we're fair game for their war. They're fair game for our war. Yeah, it goes back the other way. We don't like it when it happens to us. I don't like it when it happens to anyone. I hope you feel the same way. I mean, if you have a moral standard that you don't kill people who are unarmed, you have to look at what this country does as well as what these guys without uniforms do. Right? If you kill women and children and you have a uniform on, you're a soldier. If you kill women and children and you don't have a uniform on, you're a terrorist. I don't see the difference. And you say, oh man, he's smearing our boys. Our troops do what our leaders, they go where our leaders send them to do. They do what they're told to do. I know that that is an excuse. It doesn't always work. But the blame lies in Washington. It lies with a man who sent us into Iraq on the basis of a lie. But let me finish up with this quickly. Scherer, who headed the CIA's bin Laden unit for 9 years, sees a different way out through U.S. foreign policy. He said he resigned last November from the Bush administration to expose the U.S. leadership's willful blindness to what needs to be done. Withdraw the U.S. military from the Middle East. That's what he says, and that's what I've been saying on this show. Here's a man that studied bin Laden for 10 years. He ran the operations that tried to run bin Laden into the ground. And couldn't through the military means or through the police in Highland Park, like I was trying to protect my house. And I gave us the excuse. You know, the fallback of all these right-wingers, now that every lie that the Iraq war is based on has been exposed as an untruth, they're saying, well, isn't the world better off without, we didn't get Osama bin Laden, without Saddam Hussein? I mean, that's pretty long and complex, but let's say, yeah. Let's say we rid the world of Saddam Hussein, and we are now declaring victory. We're leaving. We're out of here. Goodbye. Thank you. I hope you can run your affairs pretty well. Oh, yeah, we owe you quite a few billion dollars because we wrecked your country and we killed 20,000 to 100,000 civilians. So here is compensation money. It's our tax money. You and I, everyone listening, are paying it, but it's better than paying it to Halliburton. It's better to paying it to all these war contractors that are ripping us off while Bush's buddies destroy Iraq and then Bush's buddies rebuild it. And this big cycle of destruction and reconstruction, all of which we pay for. Believe me, it'll be cheaper just to pay war reparations and get the hell out of there and say, look, you're right. We're out of here. We're disengaging from the Middle East. You know what? We're not giving any more money to Israel, and we're not giving any more money to Egypt. We're not giving any more money to Saudi Arabia. You know why? Because it just stirs the pot over there, number one. And number two, it's our money, and we're closing schools in the United States. We can't afford to give you billions and billions of dollars when our stuff isn't being taken care of. All right, let's look at this. Oh, yeah. So he says, withdraw the U.S. military from the Middle East, end unqualified support for Israel, and sever close ties to Arab oil state tyrannies. Well, I just said all that, right? He acknowledged such actions aren't likely soon. Hello. But said his longtime subject, bin Laden, will make us bleed enough to get our attention. And believe it, folks, if they can do it there, and it appears to be a fairly unsophisticated operation, didn't need a lot, you know, didn't need, Blofeld and James Bond. Didn't need a big operation center like that. You just get 8-10 pissed off guys that see what's happening every day in Iraq and say, we're taking some people out here. The speculation is that it's people from Britain, right? And I saw this. This is beginning to make its way all across the world, too, through the internet. Do you know what, how do they pose this now? I'm looking at this one article and it's kind of throwing me off trying to say it right because I thought it had quite an impact. Oh yeah, wave of attacks kill, what do they kill, I can't get this together. What do they call what happened, what happened in London, what do they call it in Iraq? What do they call what happened in Iraq? Man, I'm doing terrible, aren't I? What do they call what happened in London in Iraq? What do they call what happened in London in Iraq? They call it Sunday. They call it Sunday. That's what it says here. Wave of attacks killed nearly 50 in Iraq. That's today. Then just on and on. U.S. troops wounded, 48 people killed with a suicide bomber attacks and what have you. This is just daily events. And what we don't zero in on that. It's like they don't suffer like we suffer. They're closer to us. I mean, it's pretty easy. Those people speak our language in London. There's an ethnic connection with many of us. And they're invested with full humanity. Once you start moving into the darker regions of the world in terms of complexion and the class differences begin to alter significantly, people like that are thought of as sort of a mass. It's not this, it's almost like they don't suffer like we suffer. But 50 people in Iraq today killed suffered. And their families suffered just as much as the people in London did. And we got to remember that all life is sacred. And we've got to protect it all. And, the right wing already is using these attacks for more war. That's what got into all of this. The war mentality of the Bushes, the war mentality of the Osama bin Laden types and what have you. So unless we can find a way to declare peace, this is our fate. This will be our fate. Bush's endless war, of which he sees himself as the war chieftain, works to his political advantage. Maybe he can even get his sagging poll numbers up a bit. Well, that's my opinion. Jay Hudson is our producer. He's our phone screener. And let's start off with Chris from Roseville. Chris, Peter Werby, you're on the air. Hi.
Hey, Peter. How are you doing?
Doing good. What's up?
Well, I don't know. I got there just to call you because I was driving home and I see gas prices at about $2.50 a gallon up to $2.70. Just makes me think. It's one of my main issues right now.
How come?
Because I think when it really does hit and gas starts to shoot up, I mean, I know it will happen eventually, shoot up $4 to $5 a gallon, then it's going to be the Mets hit the U.S. I mean, I listen to your show on and off, but I don't particularly know your views about it.
About what? Well, gas prices? I just took, I just drove about 2,200 miles over the last couple of weeks, so how do you think I feel?
Hitting the wallet, I guess.
Yeah, for sure. Well, I was looking for one piece of information. I can't remember where I put it, but, I mean, that's another thing we... If we continue with fossil fuel production as the main source of energy, we're going to both have high gas prices and continuing wars, because ultimately this is all about control of oil in the Middle East.
Yeah, I think it's one of our main, I can't think of the word right now, one of our main interests in the Middle East.
Sure, well, interest it is.
I mean, I'm going to school right now. I'm in high school, and I want to go on to be an engineer. I want to fix these problems. And I wish we had more students like that. I wish math and science was encouraged more in today's schools. And you made the point about how war takes money away from things, like we're closing schools and that. And I'm from Roseville, and we're not the richest district in the world, and we're having troubles like that right now.
Yeah, almost every... school district is. I was in Boston, one of the cities I was in, and I'm surprised here. You think this is a nice, rich northeastern city, and they're having the same thing. Schools being closed, overcrowded, special activities being closed down. And we've spent what, depending on how you count it, to $300 billion in Iraq so far, and that's all our tax money.
And you look at the typical budget of a school district is somewhere $30 to $50 million a year. It's a huge hit.
Okay. All right, Chris. Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Peter.
Bye now. 313-298-WRIF. Actually, we had a lot of people on the line. I think my grim narrative kind of made people go, oh man, it's hopeless. Well, I don't know. we're now ourselves on an orange alert for transportation. That in fact, and the English say they've raised their alert to the highest ever level because of the London rush hour bombers, that they're still alive, and they're planning another attack. They think. I mean, if they did this one, U.S. keeping mass transit alert on orange. So the United States will keep its terror alert on high for mass transit as British officials try to determine the culprits. Now, I came from Canada today, from Canada to the United States to Port Huron. And there was a pretty big line. In fact, you know, there's a lot of customs guys that listen to this broadcast, because when I go to Windsor a lot, and they always stop and we chat. I'm waiting in line, right? In fact, maybe some of you could tell me this as well if they don't. So I'm watching these cars. They pull up there, and they have like endless, I don't know if you call it interrogation, not any questioning. I mean, they're there for a long time. 3 minutes, 5 minutes, 8 minutes, and I'm thinking, what could these people be doing? So, and it goes real, each car, it seems very long. So they get up to me, and they say, citizen of what country? I say, U.S., and my wife says, U.S., and they say, how long have you been in Canada? I said, just overnight. Okay. Whew. I'm there 45 seconds. I mean, maybe I just look like the safest guy in the world or something like that. I mean, I don't know. Probably do. But when you go in, when you come back, not when you go into Canada, but when you come into the United States, what are they asking you that they're not asking me? Or if some of my customs friends are listening, what are you asking these guys, and what triggers that? Remember one time, this is funny, I may have told you this, I won't even mention your name if you're listening, but I said that I was told the thing to do is you pull up real close, and you look at the border, I always call them border guards, not really, you know, the customs, what is their official name, customs agents? No, custom, I don't know, somebody remind me, 313-298-WRIF. And so I said on the air, you want to take off your sunglasses, first off, pull up as close as you can to them, look them straight in the eye, yada, yada, some other suggestions. So I did that one time, and so this guy says, that's right, take off your sunglasses, look me straight in the eye. I'm going, whoa, man, this guy's been listening. So what happens there? I mean, do you start stumbling, or they say, how long have you been in Canada? And you go, there's something like that, or I don't know. What keeps you at the border so long? I don't understand this real well. We should take a quick break. In the meantime, give us a call, 313-298-WRIF. We'll be right back with Night Call.
WRIF.com. And now, a word from the Riff Legal Eagles. Unless otherwise stated, all entrants for WRIF contests must be at least 18 years of age and a legal resident of the United States. A household is eligible to win one contest per 30 days every 6 months for prizes valued at $600 or higher. Greater Media Detroit and its affiliates, promotional sponsors, advertising and promotional agencies, and other radio and television stations in the Detroit ADI are not eligible to participate. One entry per person. No purchase or other consideration is necessary to participate in the contest. Void where prohibited. Prizes are not transferable or redeemable for cash. 101 WRIF reserves the right to substitute any prize for one of equal or greater value. By participating in the contest, contestants consent to the broadcast and or publication of their name, voice, face, and or likeness without compensation. Participants listening online at www.wrif.com may receive audio that is delayed by as much as 60 seconds later than the over-the-air transmission, which could potentially affect chances of winning. General contest rules are available online at www.wrif.com or during regular business hours at the WRIF Studios, 1 Radio Plaza, Detroit, Michigan, 48220.
Bill Bonds with a commercial. If you're near or farsighted and you want to throw away those glasses forever, I know a doctor you should see. Dr. Escombati. Phone number 1-877. Then the letters U-S-E-E-M-O-R-E. 1-877-UC-MORE. The equipment, the finest high-tech equipment ever made. Price $999 per eye. So don't fall for those $200 prices you hear being tossed around on the radio. Cows don't fly. Neither do those prices, unless your daddy is an eye doctor and you're getting a freebie. Dr. S. Combati, no doctor we know of has a better success rate. procedure is fast, safe, cost $999 per eye, virtually painless, you're in and out, maybe 40 minutes, procedure itself, maybe 5. When it's over, you'll want to kiss your glasses goodbye and hug the doctor. Or maybe you guys will just want to give him a hi-fi, shake hands with him, walk away, and see a whole new world. See ya.
Anglers, get ready to cast your line for big money. The OSI Pro Series WRAF Great Lakes Fishing Championship Series is underway, and there's still time to enter to win the $1,500 Series Championship. Sign up now for the Bass Championship going out of Lake Erie Metro Park on July 30th. Slots will fill up fast, so get your entry in now. Compete for thousands of dollars in cash and prizes, including the DMF Bait Award for the kid under 16 landing the largest fish on live bait. It's all going to be given away to the best fishing team in town, so sign up now by calling 248-591-6841 or go to WRIF.com for an entry form. There will be fun for everyone at the post-event party at Big Al Sports Grill, so call 248-591-6841 to become the OSI Pro Series WRIF Great Lakes Fishing Series Champion. Call 248-591-6841 today. Brought to you by OSI Pro Series, the DMF Bait Company, Big Al Sports Grill, and 101 WRIF.
Every day, employers search for people skilled in today's technology. Are you ready for a change to a new career? Make a difference for yourself by calling the ITT Technical Institutes at 1-800-396-6622. Find out how an ITT Tech can help you prepare for a career in electronics, information technology, or drafting and design. Nationwide, thousands have launched technical careers after graduating from an ITT Tech. Classes meet just a few times a week to help you balance school and your job. Financial aid is available for those who qualify, and career assistance is available once you graduate. Now is your chance to make a difference for yourself, to start a new path to a career involving technology. Find out what an ITT Tech education can offer you. Call 1-800-396-6622 for an ITT Tech brochure. Classes are forming now, so call ITT Tech at 1-800-396-6622. That's 1-800-396-6622.
Hey, Tigers fans, this summer, why sit at home when you could sit at home? Fight, that is. Now is a great time to catch all the fun and excitement happening at every Detroit Tigers home game. You'll see plenty of homers by Pudge Rodriguez, Dimitri Young, Carlos Guillen, and all your favorite players. But a trip to Comerica Park means more than just baseball. While the Tigers are driving home runs, you could drive home in a brand new car during the Chevy Cobalt Drive One Home Giveaway, sponsored by your Detroit area Chevy dealers. Just buy a ticket to select Friday or Saturday night home games, and you could drive one out of here. Looking for a surefire hit? Hey, don't miss Friday and Saturday night fireworks, sponsored by Pepsi and Verizon Wireless.
Now, Night Call is back on 101 WRIF Detroit. Here's your host, Peter Werby.
All right, thank you very much. Welcome back. Yeah, it's really good after, I guess, a couple of years of being in the minority to suddenly have majority opinions. Majority of people now think that Bush lied about getting us into war in Iraq. 42% say that he should be impeached if this could be shown to be, in fact, the case, which I think would be pretty easy to do. And also, here we have an expert on terrorism say that we are not going to be able to end this wave of terrorism by having a, quote, war on terror. I mean, why do we need atomic bunker busters for a war on terror? These are three or four men who take bombs and put them on subways. They can do that anywhere. Have you ever been at a rock concert? Or, I mean, I go to a rock concert, big one like Palace or a small club, and talking about Hamtramck earlier, club in Hamtramck or Detroit Symphony Orchestra, and maybe I'm just paranoid. Passes through my mind, think there's no security at these places. I mean, there's more at, like, some of these rock venues, but they're certainly not at the Detroit Symphony Orchestra. I mean, there's nobody looking in your backpacks there. Anyway, 313-298-WRIF. So this terrorism expert, man who was tracking Osama bin Laden, says, disengage from the Middle East, essentially. I'd also add to that, we have to get out oil. Saudi Arabia has informed the United States that they cannot meet quotas. They will not be able to meet U.S. needs by 2015. That's 10 years from now. 10 years goes by pretty quickly. So this is going to be this scramble more and more for scarcer and scarcer resources. And so we can make war on the whole world and hope that we take just small hits. Small hits like September 11th. And Madrid, and London, and Bali. Small hits, he says? You call 3,000 people small hits? Yeah. compared to 20,000 and 100,000 like the Iraqis have suffered. World War II, you know, Russians, 20 million. Yeah. 313-298-WRIF. Jamie writes in to calltalkyes@yahoo.com. Just wanted you to know how far your broadcast reaches. Tucson loves you. It was 110 degrees today. Oh, my God. Me and my buds are just sitting around sweating and waiting for the monsoon rains. We all look forward to your show every week. Tucson is a blue county surrounded by a red state. We're a small progressive stronghold surrounded by right-wing insanity, and all my friends really appreciate the cool links on your webpage. Well, thank you, Jamie. He says, remind the folks in Michigan how lucky they are to have reasonable summer weather. Well, it's supposed to be 94 tomorrow, so we don't really think that. But better than Tucson or Phoenix or some temperature like that, yeah. Well, thank you. And also, hello to David listening in Westport. I wanted to say that shout-out, first-time listener. Laura writes in, Peter, I think the only way to get the attention of the Bush administration is to call for a general strike. No work, no purchase, nothing. Shut down the economy for a week, even 3 days. Money is all they understand. Ooh, did I say your name already from an anonymous listener? I may have said your first name. Sorry. Anyway, yeah, but general strikes, they do that in Europe. And it does, in fact, get people's attention. Nick in Ypsilanti, Michigan, waiting patiently. You're on the air. Go ahead.
Hey, Peter.
Hi.
Yeah, I recently, actually, before the elections, I saw a bumper sticker which said, like, 9 out of 10 terrorists support Kerry. In retrospect, Terrorists.
Parrots?
Terrorists.
Parents.
Terrorists. Sorry?
Wait, you spell it for me. You got a terrible connection.
Sorry. T-E-R-R-O-R.
Oh, terrorists.
Terrorists.
9 out of 10 terrorists. Yeah, that was a little bit of the right-wing nonsense.
Yes, but I mean, in retrospect, if I was Al-Qaeda, I would be happy with Bush.
Sure, Bush has played right into their hands.
I mean, for what Bush gave him a great gift. When he sent the troops to Iraq, he gave a perfect opportunity that no longer Bush is on the offensive with Al-Qaeda. Now the Al-Qaeda is on the offensive with America. They're
sure.
The insurgents in Iraq. They can blend in with the regular crowd in Iraq, and they can set up bombs, blow up cars. I mean, like, this is a golden opportunity Bush has given to Al-Qaeda. This is just one of the many blunders of the Bush administration.
Yeah, I'm surprised we see his like approval rating down to 42%. I'm thinking, who are the 42% that could still support him? Somewhere along, I actually am more disorganized than usual here. Oh yeah, maybe this is in here. Yeah, here's what it is. It says among those living in the western states, no, that's for impeachment. All right, here. More significant sign of the weaknesses of the president's poll numbers, more red state voters, that is, voters living in the states that cast their ballots for Bush and Cheney, now rate his job performance unfavorably, with 50% holding a negative view. But that wasn't even the one I was looking for. It was, this was about impeachment. Among those living in the western states, 52% majority favors Congress using the impeachment mechanism against Bush, while just 41% are opposed in eastern states. 49% are in favor, 45% in the South are opposed. In the South, meanwhile, impeachment is opposed by 60% and supported by only 34%. Unfortunately for the Great Lakes region, 52% are opposed, 38% in favor. But the majority, not a majority, I guess it's not a majority, 42% say they would favor impeachment proceedings if it is found the president misled the nation about his reasons for going to war in Iraq. Well, gee, isn't that... I mean, we know that now, right?
I mean, yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
I think people are just finally waking up to a Bush. I mean, it was like people like me, you, Michael Moore, and everyone else on the street with signs protesting, and other people were thinking that this war was a good thing. Well, now people are realizing, hey, we were right.
Yeah, why do we need a Vietnam every single generation to remind us of the futility of these adventures across the ocean, thinking that our military might is going to be able to suppress these local insurgencies? Just ain't possible. All right, thank you very much, Nick. Appreciate it. Let's see here. Our next caller is from Dave from Oakland. Dave, it's Peter Werbe. You're on the air. Hi.
Hey, Peter. How's it going?
Going good, thanks.
Good. You having a good summer?
Yeah, so far.
Yeah. Well, listen. I used to, you know, I've called in a few times, and I used to be in customs, as a matter of fact.
Okay. Good. Well,
now patrolling the streets, but. Yeah, they got a pretty tough job at the border, but they basically, you know, they use nonverbal cues and things like that and different types of questions to eliminate, you know, who they want to send in and who they don't.
What's the proper title for the person in the booth?
You know, they've changed it. It used to be customs inspector or immigration inspector, depending on who you were talking to at the time, because both agencies work there, but they've combined them all under Homeland Security, and I'm not exactly sure what their exact title is anymore. But if they've all combined, there really isn't a true Customs Service and Immigration Service. They're all under I believe, Homeland Security now, whereas Customs used to be under the Treasury Department, and that's not the case anymore.
Well, Dave, that's the other thing. You said who to question further. They don't seem to send anybody over to those inspection booths anymore. They just question people endlessly at the booth and open up their trunks and you know, stuff like that. Whereas it used to be, if they had any major questions beyond just where you been and all that, they would send you right away over to the customs. What would you call it? Center.
That's secondary inspection, and yeah, that is pretty accurate. When I was working at the border in Port Huron, that is pretty much what we do. We would eliminate the people pretty quickly after a few questions. Now, they may have changed, and I haven't worked there since 9/11, so they may have definitely changed their policies on how they do things, you know, at the primary inspection area. That's where you actually cross the border and talk to them at the booth. So they may have changed the way they do things to a certain degree. And there is times when you may, depending on the situation, you may ask a few more questions there, and you may even pop open a trunk. But generally, that wasn't the rule, you know, when I was working there.
Yeah, well, I mean, I fly 4 or 5 times a year, so whatever security measures they want to take are fine. I don't have the slightest, objection. But I was thinking, they could. In fact, I told some other people who were going into the States from Canada through a different route, and I was saying, well, expect after this London thing that it's going to be a little beefed up. And I was thinking, though, I mean, are terrorists really going to come in over the border? I mean, I have sailed from the U.S. to Canada. I have kayaked. Let me see if there's any other way. I have motored. So, I mean, I've been on a motorboat, I've been on a kayak, and, you know, you're supposed to, as soon as you hit Canadian soil, you're supposed to call the Canadian officials. When I was on a big sailboat, I did. When I was in a kayak,
Right. Well, I think that the two of the people that were involved in 9/11, the terrorists, I believe they came across one of the borders, I think, in Maine, and they had actual visas that the immigration department had stamped and okayed. So, the terrorists, they're under disguise as far as, you know, what their intentions are when they come in the country. And it takes a great deal of, you know, looking mm-hmm. into individuals. So, I mean, really, to shut everybody down, you're going to have to shut the whole country down.
And you can't do that.
So I think they're doing the best that they can, you know, and their technology has increased a huge amount since I worked there, since 9/11, and they've got a lot more tools to work with, and they've got a faster, for people who frequently cross the border, they can get special passes where we know this person's okay, and they just can zip right through
sure.
the commuters.
You're starting to break up, Dave. So thank
okay.
you, appreciate
yep,
it.
Peter, take care.
Bye bye. I don't know if I told you this about. Maybe a year ago now, I took these tests. It's irrelevant why, but they included some nucleotides into my system. Turned out I was perfectly okay, which I thought, but under today's medical system, you are ill till proven well, right? So I had to take these tests, and I said, I don't need this. This is ridiculous. They say, well, you know, you never can tell. So I went dutifully off and took them. And this was on a Thursday. On a Friday, I was going to go visit a friend in Windsor. And one of the lab technicians says to me, you plan to go to Canada tomorrow? Oh, how do they know, man? What's going on here? And I said, well, yeah, I am. Why? And they said, well, you'll probably set off the alarms. So they have these nuclear detectors. So I said, well, I really have to meet this person. And they said, well, we can give you a letter. I said, fine, give me a letter. So I get this. They give me this letter, this handwritten letter. Say, he has just had something with nucleotides or some word like that in it. And that's why he may show high radiation. And so I looked at it, and I'm thinking, this looks like I wrote it myself, so I didn't even go. So they do have these. So if you're trying to bring, like, a dirty bomb, something like that, they're not going to go for it. All right, here's Mike in Jackson. Mike, it's Peter Werby. You're on the air. Thanks for calling 313-298-WRIF. Hi.
Hi, Peter.
Hi.
I got a question. A couple weeks ago, you mentioned that when Bush was riding his bike and the Capitol was possibly under attack when that plane invaded the White House airspace and he wasn't notified until after his bike ride.
Right.
Who really makes those decisions? He clearly looks like a puppet to me on television. And how does that management structure work out? Is Karl Rove notified before the president, or how does that work out?
I don't know. That's a good question. I hate guessing and things like this. He was having trouble biking. Didn't he run into a Scottish cop the other day?
Yeah, correct.
Yeah,
that
he
was
did.
A different incident.
And yeah, I always think, too, he crashed that, what's that, a Segway. Remember that they had that motor scooter that could was uncrashable?
Uh-huh.
He crashed it. Well, that's all over the place. So I don't know who makes those decisions, but somebody decided not to tell Bush, just let him go for his bike ride. Okay, thank you. Appreciate it. That's all I really have on that. Here's Becky calling in from, is it Casco?
Casco, Michigan.
Hi, welcome. Go ahead. You're on the air, Becky. Hey, Becky.
No, I'm not.
Yes, you are, Becky.
No, I'm not. I'm listening.
Well, it's because you have your radio on, and you should have been listening on the phone.
Oh, okay, I'm on.
But turn your radio completely off.
Okay, I'm going to turn it completely off.
Well, all right, here. I'm going to talk, and you just listen for a minute, and then you can regroup your thoughts. We're on about an 8-second delay, so what we need is people listening on the telephone and not on their radio, because the radio will throw you off. Where's Casco, Becky?
Now I'm echoing to hear it.
What?
Probably 20 miles south of Fort Huron.
Okay, I was just up that way today. So what's on your mind, Becky?
What's that?
What's on your mind?
Just listening to you talk about Bin Laden and all that, and it's like cool.
Yeah.
But I don't know, and you're like ragging on Bush.
Yeah.
Which is okay.
Yeah.
And I was just listening to it. It was like great to a point, and then you're like really ragging on him.
I was nicer tonight than usual, but go ahead.
Okay, and he is for the rich people.
Mm-hmm.
I believe that totally. So, what do we do about it?
Well, that's the, what do they used to call it, the how much dollar question?
Yeah.
The 50 something, but now it's like the $1 million question. Well, somebody along the line's got to get some spunk. I mean, there's two ways to do things.
I got spunk. Sweetheart.
Well, there's got to be a lot of us. I mean, first off, too many of us depend on the Democratic Party to be an opposition party, which it isn't. It doesn't function well as that, and they're mostly a pack of weenies. So they can have, like, an election stolen from them, and they don't do anything. They're afraid. They got a little spunk once in a while when they say, oh, public opinion is turning against Bush. Maybe we can say something, too. And then all of a sudden, they'll go, we got to watch ourselves. The other way is what's always happened throughout history, no matter, beginning with the American Revolution, is the people themselves take direct action. I mean, look at, most people don't know about this stuff, but in Ecuador, They've driven like three presidents in a row from office because he was selling out the country.
Go to Chile, too. Okay, I'm sorry.
Yeah.
No, you said Ecuador. Let's go to Chile.
Okay.
It's the same thing, is it not?
Well, no analogy is direct, but in some ways, you've got the big question. I mean, what do we do? And unfortunately, we almost have to invent our answers from the ground up, because if the Democratic Party won't do anything and there's not any mass movement going, what do we do? I mean, that's right.
Okay. So we could just sit here, me and you, and down everybody, and just say Bush is a, can I say this, an ass?
Yeah.
Yeah, big time, okay? But there's nothing right now that we can do about this.
Well, there are groups, and there are people.
Give me alternatives.
All right, I would go, all right, here's one. You can go to my, all right, wait. For one thing, I don't know, do you have internet access?
Yes.
Okay, you go to my website. And I'm not selling anything, so this doesn't do me. This is just about ideas.
That's
fine. You can go to my website. My first name is Peter, and my last name is Werbe, spelled W-E-R-B-E. W-E-R-B-E. And if you go to Peter,
Werbe. I got it.
PeterWerbe.com, and okay. There's all sorts of links to people and groups that are doing things that you don't hear reported on too much, that are working at the grassroots levels. Everything from Iraqi military veterans who are opposing the war to, families of...
Can I call you Peter?
Call me Peter, sure.
Okay, Peter.
I insist.
Okay.
Go ahead, because I got to...
Well, now I lost my train of thought.
Well, all right. Well, good. Let me just finish up, Becky, by saying I didn't want to just leave it on war stuff. For people that are trying to do stuff about the economy, that are trying to do make some sense of why in the richest country in the world we have so many poor people, why the middle class is taking so many hits, why our schools are closing, on and on and on. Why we have the resources in our country and in the world to make things so much better than they are. Why do they keep being so awful? And that's the big question, and people are addressing them. All right, Becky, I'm sorry to cut you off, but I have to do these spots before midnight. So let's keep thinking about your question, because it's the key one, and we'll talk again. Thank you.
This is WRIM.com. Want to get to the next level of your career? If working harder at your job won't help, work smarter by earning a bachelor's or master's degree at University of Phoenix, the nation's largest accredited private university. It's college designed for busy working adults. In most cases, you can earn a degree in only 2 to 3 years. To find out how, call 1-800-664-1391. At the University of Phoenix Detroit campus, the small classes are designed for working adults with busy lives. You'll cover more material in less time with convenient classes in the evening or on the weekend. At University of Phoenix, you can do this. Call now for a brochure on degree programs in business, technology, nursing, education, and more. 1-800-664-1391. Programs vary by campus. Call University of Phoenix now, 1-800-664-1391. That's 1-800-664-1391. And now, a word from the Riff Legal Eagles. Unless otherwise stated, all entrants for WRIF contests must be at least 18 years of age and a legal resident of the United States. A household is eligible to win one contest per 30 days every 6 months for prizes valued at $600 or higher. Greater Media Detroit and its affiliates, promotional sponsor, advertising and promotional agencies, and other radio and television stations in the Detroit ADI are not eligible to participate. One entry per person. No purchase or other consideration is necessary to participate in the contest. Void where prohibited. Prizes are non-transferable or redeemable for cash. 101 WRIF reserves the right to substitute any price for one of equal or greater value. By participating in the contest, contestants consent to the broadcast and or publication of their name, voice, face, and or likeness without compensation. Participants listening online at www.wrif.com may receive audio that is delayed by as much as 60 seconds later than the over-the-air transmission, which could potentially affect chances of winning. General contest rules are available online at www.wrif.com or during regular business hours at the WRIF Studios, 1 Radio Plaza, Detroit, Michigan, 48220.
Like what you hear on the Riff? Then why not get your Riff Rock to go? Download all your favorite Riff tunes right now with the Riff Music Store online at WRIF.com. Riff rocks. Rocks. You're listening to WRIF.com.
Or visit FordVehicles.com and welcome to the family.
We're back with more Night Call on 101 WRIF Detroit. Here's Peter Werby.
All right, thank you very much. Welcome back to our second hour. If you're just joining us, 313-298-WRIF for email. Call talkyes at yahoo.com. My website, peterwerby.com, P-E-T-E-R-W-E-R-B-E.com. This whole show will be rebroadcast at radiopower.org at 9 a.m. and 6 p.m. tomorrow. That's Eastern Time. And after that, will be archived at whiterosesociety.org. It's all that information, if it's going by too fast, will be available for you at my website, peterwerby.com. Yeah, we're talking about the London bombing. And how will we alter, how will we end this now seemingly endless war, and with the capacity of a few men to strike where they decide, with relatively little technological devices. It seems like they need explosives and a cell phone. Boom. That's it. And they seem to be going down the line of those countries that have supported U.S. Middle East policy. And I was reading earlier from the recommendations of the man who was in charge in the United States government, including under Clinton and under Bush, of tracking Osama bin Laden. And he said that we have to alter our foreign policy. that we are going to continue like this endlessly. In fact, that things are increasingly getting worse. That Bush's policies are creating more and more terrorists, not less. More people are dying from terrorist acts. And he said, let me just make sure I'm not mixing in my opinions with this, but essentially they're the same. He resigned from the government last November to expose the U.S. leadership's willful blindness to what needs to be done. Withdraw the U.S. military from the Mideast, end unqualified support from Israel, sever close ties to Arab oil state tyrannies. And Egypt, which isn't an oil state tyranny, just a tyranny that gets a few billion dollars a year, courtesy of you and me. Now, one of the articles I was looking for earlier was by Patrick Dougherty. He wrote, Why London, Why Now? It's in Tom Paine. .com, P-A-I-N-E, the great American patriot. He says, he's assuming that this was the work of Al-Qaeda, and he said that what has to be done is to stop, go to the heart of what is at Islamic extremism, climate change and poverty. And what he says is addressing climate change requires radically improving transportation fuel efficiency and transitioning off fossil fuels as a source of energy. To the extent that the United States and the rest of the world adopt sensible climate change policies, the strategic importance of the Persian Gulf diminishes and America has more room to promote real democracy and economic reform in the region. Now, how long have you heard that on this program? How many years, right, of ending fossil fuel dependency, not only to end wars, but for ecological sense as well? Oil production is poisonous at every level. It drains. You know, people complain. We had a caller earlier, and I just came back from a long trip, auto trip, complaining about gas now as much as $2.50 for regular. It could go up to $4. We really pay a lot more. Because the hundreds of billions of dollars that have probably translated into a trillion or more over the years to protect U.S. access to oil in the Middle East probably means we're paying $15 a gallon. You get that? I mean, we pay taxes. They take 25%, a third of our taxes. And it doesn't go back to us to create this beautiful country with everything we need in it and great classrooms and, you know, no crime and, you know, public health programs that include a national health program and all that. It goes to the military. The world spends $1 trillion a year on military. Well, I mean, who are they? Who's fighting here? And the United States, us, courtesy of you and me, spend half of that. We spend $500 billion a year preparing for war with who's this now? Four guys in London? That doesn't make a bit of sense. So this is a rat hole down which the possibilities of a world without all the travesties that we see now just become impossible. Because we're wasting our money. We're fighting ourselves. We're robbing ourselves. We're allowing ourselves to be looted. I mean, not lots of people profit off this. Believe it. The owners of Halliburton and those folks, they're doing great off of this. And we're paying the cost. It's always the common people that get ground up. Remember I said earlier, these right-wing forces are fighting Bush against Al-Qaeda, and we're in the crossfire. Because we're sensible enough to know that. And if we set our engineers to work, we could easily come up with alternative, workable alternative energy, that combined with great amount of conservation. And we wouldn't be facing all this. And all this means everything from war to poverty. From illness to environmental destruction. We don't have to accept that. And in a while, you know, it's like medical stuff. You catch stuff early, you can deal with it. If you let it go a long time, and sometimes it's fatal. Sometimes it's fatal. And some people say that we're at a point of no return. I don't like to think that. They think environmentally we've passed the point of no return, and they think politically that we've passed the point of no return as well. It's all downhill from here. I'd like to think that's not true. In this article, Doherty says, to show just how dire our global energy situation is, Saudi Arabia announced today that OPEC will not be able to meet Western demand for oil by 2015, only 10 years out. Given the timing, this is Saudi Arabia effectively saying that the time has come to turn to more efficient use of oil, which is also one of the main ways of dealing with climate change. Saudi Arabia just undercut the Bush administration's position at the G8 conference. Bush lies every time he opens his mouth. I mean, sometimes he's just so stupid he doesn't know what he's talking about. Other times, I mean, he's either saying dumb things or lies. He's got two modes here. And when he says he couldn't sign the Kyoto Treaty, because it would wreck the U.S. economy. This is a combination of stupidity and lies. He takes his two main modes and combines them. People go, oh, well, hell, we don't want to wreck the U.S. economy. We better not put any brake on the kind of poisons that his buddies who have contributed millions of dollars to his campaign, we wouldn't put any restrictions on them. They can continue to poison us. We can continue to have an epidemic of cancer and an epidemic of asthma, all directly related to pollution, because we don't want to wreck the economy. Now, how do these other countries that have signed the Kyoto Accords, how have they not wrecked their economy? I mean, without going into a long thing, I was just listening to somebody talk about the kind of ways they deal with so much of this in Europe. Well, all right, actually, let me just real quickly tell you about some of these emails. Dennis writes into calltalkyes@yahoo.com. He suggests talking about health care. This is going to be on the ballot in 18 states next year to propose a Canadian health care system. Our nearest neighbor, Ohio, is putting it on their ballot. An interesting side point, when General Motors decided to build its plant recently in Ontario, remember, bye-bye Motor City, hello McDonald's, the reason they gave was health care, and he says Toyota, same thing. What that means is they don't have to pay for the health care. The citizens do as part of the government. Doesn't that make a lot of sense? Roy, listening out in New Mexico, sent in this item I saw. The daughter of the world's most influential evangelist was arrested last week in the parking lot of a discount store, probably Walmart, right? Accused of domestic battery against her husband. Virginia Graham Foreman, 59, Billy Graham's daughter, spent the night in jail, New Smyrna Beach, after she tried to strangle her husband. I don't know why I think that's funny. It's probably pretty sad, but there you go. Out in Livingston, Montana, Jack is listening. He says, I wonder if the powerful explosive used in London is what was looted at the Al-Qaeda storage facility in Iraq. I hadn't thought about that. Remember the United States, when we invaded, it's going to be a walkthrough. They're going to throw flowers. So the only thing the United States did was to go protect the oil ministry, because that's why we invaded. But all this, just millions of pounds of ordnance was just looted. Weapons, explosives, and what have you. Jack, out listening out of Montana, is wondering whether or not that could be part of it that came back again to bite us in the butt. I mean, Osama bin Laden was a CIA operative against the Russians. That's another great idea that didn't work too well. Thank you, Ronald Reagan. Actually, thank you, Jimmy Carter, too, but mostly Reagan. Now, maybe it doesn't want me to say this, but Jack, if you're listening, do you have a neighbor, an author named Elwood, first name? Buddy of mine, actually, yeah, well, ask him, because Livingston's a pretty small town. I was out there, but I was going to drop down to see him in Livingston, but it just turned out to be little too far. But if you see him and you know him, tell him I said hello and I gave him a shout out on the air. Okay, let's go back to our phones and say hello to Dennis. Dennis is listening in Detroit. Dennis, hi, it's Peter Werby. You're on the air.
Hi, Peter.
Hi.
Hurricane Dennis here.
Yeah, well, go ahead. Blow on.
Okay. This is off the subject, but I want to talk about mortgages.
Sure.
Okay, maybe you and your listeners can enlighten us on about how everybody is and touting how great their mortgages are.
Uh-huh.
Well, I saw an article on your favorite media, TV.
Yeah.
About investors, from Asia. You know, in other words, these people that have companies here, they get investors from Asia.
Okay.
And they turn around and they, in other words, if something goes wrong, the people here are responsible for it. So how do you get people in Asia or whatever, wherever it is, to, you know, in other words, all the payments that you made and this and that, you lose your house,
mm-hmm.
you know, maybe, you know, people in your listening audience could maybe enlighten more on that. Or
well, I'll tell you, it's all pretty complex. I mean, we see the situation where this Chinese oil, the government, oil consortium has made a bid to buy Unocal. And so they would own directly this big American oil firm. And essentially right now, because of Bush policies, the whole country is being financed in part. The whole country is being financed in part. That doesn't make a lot of sense. In part, the country is being financed by the Chinese and Japanese banks buying treasury bonds. And they're getting a little nervous. Their return isn't all that wonderful. And also, they don't have any way to determine how these how the U.S. economy is being managed. And they see it's not being managed very well. There's a big deficit. It's growing more and more. The United States is in a war, wasting all these money that should be used domestically, going down the drain. And so they want to actually intervene directly in the U.S. economy. How that affects mortgage rates, I don't know. I mean, we have an economy, capitalism, that is, even the high priests don't know how it really works. And they argue about how, you know, what's going to happen. I mean, you can pick up enough literature to say that we're going to hell in a handbasket and quickly. And you get these other people that are saying, oh, everything's fine, invest more money. I don't know. I'd get a generator. That's what I say. All right. Maybe some other people will comment, though. Thank you. Here, this is one of my favorite remarks. Mark writes in from Columbus, Michigan. It's not practical to use anything other than fossil fuels. It's the cheapest source of energy. Gee, you think so, Mark? I mean, even after what I said, in order to get oil out of the ground, you have to launch a $200 to $300 billion war. That kind of pumps up the price of it. And I say it wrecks the environment. It's poisonous when it's pumped. It's poisonous when it's shipped. It's poisonous when it's refined. And it's poisonous when it's burned. And we suck it all up. So that's not good. So cheap, I'm not sure that's always the best idea. Anyways, first off, there could be absolute massive conservation. Massive conservation. In fuel economy, and remember, I don't know, you ever see from like maybe the 70s, is turn off the light to save energy. Sounds kind of silly. But now they have all these fluorescent lights that can take the place of incandescent. And you go everywhere and you see these buildings with spotlights on them. And I don't even know how much that all amounts to. But believe it, we could cut into it a lot by conservation. And then so what? What if it did cost us more? I mean, like per gallon or however you'd measured it out for our energy use, could it be worse than the military waste? Could it be worse than the environmental damage? I mean, I don't think so. So I don't think this makes a lot of sense to say it's the cheapest source. But, hey, your opinion, please. Let's go to Maurice in Inkster. Maurice, hi, it's Peter Werby. You're on
the
air.
Hey, Peter, how you doing, man?
I'm doing.
You had a nice holiday and vacation.
I did, thank you.
A couple of, about an hour ago, you asked the question, why every generation we have a Vietnam?
Yeah.
Are you familiar with a composer about the guy by the name of Gil Scott Heron?
Well, who's that?
Gil Scott Heron.
Oh, Gil Scott Heron, sure.
Okay, the military, the monetary, the monetary, the military.
Uh-huh.
You know, these people, like Halliburton, the people, the bond people get the money from the company. I forgot what you call them, the investors. Every 25 years, they got to regenerate. They pay their fortune.
Yeah.
And another thing.
Gil Scott Heron, people probably know him best. Oh, he's done tons of albums. Kind of fallen on hard personal times, but his song people might know the most is The Revolution Will Not Be Televised.
Yeah, you know, everybody howling about over there in the East. See, people forget 900 years ago, during, it was a war over in the Bosnia somewhere, was fought on a place called the Fields of the Blackbird, where the Muslims kicked the Europeans' butt.
Huh.
And, see, don't worry about that. What we have to worry about is the Pacific Rim. Because if China, North Korea, and Japan ever get together, they're going to need oil, too. So, United States better stop pulling their people out of the war and keep trying to be the big bully of the world.
Well, I'll tell you, Maurice, that is the strategy, that we will be able to occupy and control the source of this ever more scarce resource, oil. So it demands this enormous military. I mean, Condoleezza Rice, again, she's talking about... It's worrisome to her that China is building up its military. I mean, there I forget what it is. It's 10% of ours. I mean, their country is what in terms of population? Three, four, five times larger, and they're spending about $50 billion a year. We're spending $500 billion a year. You would think the other way around. You should say China concerned about U.S. military buildup, because. Countries always have this sense of the need of big armed force and what have you, but they see that much of what the U.S. does, and it's what it's doing right now in the Middle East, as directly aimed at them, because we're talking about decreasing availability, increasing demand. What does that provide? Yeah, right. All right, thank you, Maurice. I appreciate it very much, you taking the time to call in. Here is Mike and Warren. Mike, thanks for calling 313-298-WRIF.
How are you, Peter?
Doing good, thanks.
Excellent. I just wanted to make a point and see if anybody would respond to it, any of the other listeners. I find that an observation that most people that support the war to the greatest extent are also tend to be people that support having and owning a lot of guns. They seem to go hand in hand. The greater the support for the war, the more they tend to think that way also. They tend to have a very punitive view of existence.
Well, very fearful as well.
Well, exactly. I think it's very shame-based. In its,
shame-based.
In its origin. If you look at the work done by a lot of famous people like John Bradshaw on alcoholic families,
uh-huh.
they have very textbook patterns of behaviors that, to an individual growing up in such an environment, they wouldn't realize that this is all textbook stuff. They would just take it in as normal. And I think if you look at the entire so-called right wing, which includes the confluence of religious aspects of the country too, because they're also very shame-based. That's where you get this prevailing way things are going right now, just because they can play the shame and the fear cards, and still most of the people in this country are so personally dysfunctional on an individual level that they're going to go for it every time, even when the evidence of their demise is all around them. They're still going to follow obvious sets of lies based on just shame.
Sure. Well, it also translates into a personality type that they identify as authoritarian. And the idea of challenging the people above them in the hierarchy is something they can never do. No matter how tough the exterior, no matter how many gun racks and NRA stickers and all of that, they're still just they're frightened of people in authority.
So finally, very quickly, my question is to those people: if your basis for having guns here is because every person has a solemn right to defend themselves through arms against unjust tyranny committed against them by their own government, which is sworn to protect them, then how could you deny the need of people around the world to also have arms to protect themselves against your government, which has no code to protect them?
Let's see if we'll get an answer.
Take care.
Thank you. Appreciate your call, Mike. All right. Here is here's Dan out in Chelsea. Chelsea with this is going to sound odd to you, Dan, with a wonderful cemetery.
Hey, Peter, how are you?
Hi.
Hey, Peter.
I used to hang out, and not hang out a lot, but I've been to your cemetery a number of times, just kind of visiting it.
Oh yeah, it's fun. It's actually kind of morbidly fun to go through old cemeteries. No doubt about it. Peter, this thing about the Valerie Plame investigation.
Yeah, you're going to have to do a lot of explaining with that. Every once in a while, I think about bringing it up, and it's so complicated. Can you give us a shorthand?
Well, basically, somebody in the Bush administration leaked the name of a CIA operative to members of the media.
Which is a federal crime.
Which is a federal crime.
Right.
But I just want to say, can you even imagine the stink the right-wingers would be raising had someone in the Clinton administration done this?
Sure. Yeah.
I mean, there would be 10 special prosecutors by now investigating everything imaginable. Some people don't realize one of the reasons why the Bush administration has been able to not have the appearance of as much scandal is that they allowed the special prosecutor statute to expire shortly after they took office.
Right.
Or I think there would be a slew of special prosecutors investigating a lot of things in the Bush administration.
Well, you would think so. I mean, the connection with Enron. Remember how that was breaking in May and June and July, and that's when Karl Rove decided to play the Iraq card. I mean, they were going to do it at some time or other, but they said, look, we've got the 2002 elections coming up. Bush's, the shine had gone off of his poll numbers from 2001, and they were starting to go back to where they were on, like, September 10th, 2001. And so they said, now's the time. I mean, the Enron scandal was beginning to break, and it was clear that they had written the Cheney energy policy. And the words like Enron and Ken Lay, I mean, it was... what he's called, Kenny Baby, wasn't that his Bush's
Kenny name? Boy?
Kenny Boy, that's right, Kenny Boy.
Yeah. You know, Peter, not to sound, I'm not saying this is conspiratorial, but it's almost uncanny to me how every time it seems this administration is getting itself into deep trouble, something big with terrorism happens. Remember the Saturday before the election that Bin Laden tape miraculously came out?
Sure.
And I'm convinced that may have swung the election for Bush. But there's been other things. And, you know, this week you have the thing in London, right as this Rove story was about to hit real big.
And that goes back to that Rove may have been the illegal source of this information. You know, actually, I was trying to think how I could explain this case in shorthand, but it's tough to do. If people are interested in this, they should. Who's been following it pretty closely is like BuzzFlash.com, BuzzFlash.com, and a number of other sites as well. But it's just further evidence of the corruption of the Bush administration.
Well, you could say it's a treasonous act to out a CIA agent and endanger their life. And I think Ann Coulter ought to write a book, Treason 2, and it ought to deal with this. What do you think?
There you go. Thank you, Dan. Appreciate it. Thanks for calling us up. Is there anyone here? I want to see this one. Hi, it's WRIF. Are you there? Oh, my God. Don't tell me. Wow. All right. What could that have been? Here's James in Westland. Hi.
Hey, Pete.
Hi.
I want to talk a little bit about the G8 summit in Africa.
Yeah, sure. That's good. What you do?
Well, the reason why they were going to G8 was to talk about the poverty in Africa and global warming, right?
Right.
Well, from my point of view, the poverty in Africa is twofold. A, you have like all the political people being buttheads, if you will, and not running their countries right, and all the wars and stuff like that. And it's also environmental. Like the Sahara Desert grows every year by miles. All the
desertization, as they call it, yeah.
Right. All the lakes dry up and creates all these sandstorms that actually cross the ocean and hit all these islands in the Caribbean, causing asthma and killing reefs and fish. And that's all because of all the heat that is being caused by our cars and all these factories and stuff like that.
Well, you got to remember, everything that's happening in Africa, a lot of what's happening in Asia, and much of what's happening in Latin America is a result of the colonialism and imperialism of the West that dominated those regions to loot it for 100, 150 years in some cases. And it has never recovered, particularly Africa has never recovered. And what we see is the symptoms of a dominated people, destroyed cultures. So you have the kind of situation, for instance, we keep going back to Iraq. I mean, Iraq wasn't a country, but Britain, in order to control it after it gave up direct colonial control of it, here's a little island up in the northern tier of the world. And it has its colonies down there, which it essentially is just looting. So they decide, well, we'll put these three people together, the Kurds and the Iraqi Shiites and the Iraqi Sunnis. And for one thing, they'll always be at each other's throats. So they'll be able to be manipulated politically. Then they revolt, and the United Kingdom has these wars of suppression, much of what the U.S. is doing. This is in the late teens and early 20s. This insurgency goes on. Finally, after the British kill innumerable people, use poison gas on them and all this, finally they get some puppet government installed. In other regions, they've just been left to go to hell, like in Africa, that were British and German and Dutch and Portuguese colonies. And so, much like we see inner cities, where we look at them and we go, tisk, 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 those people have made such a mess of their lives, it's very frequently external causes. Not to let any of these tin pot dictators in Africa off the hook. I mean, they are awful. But they're simply taking a card from their previous colonial masters and looting all that they can. All right, thank you so much. I appreciate your call. Now the G8 leaders are going to give $50 billion in African aid. That's about as much as China spends on its military, 10% of what the United States does. Now, this is our tax dollars again. I don't like this. The only thing that I've ever maybe even agreed with Rush Limbaugh, he said the other day, he said that, this liberal conference, what a jerk this guy is, is going to save Africa again. You know, he said it very cynically. I don't agree with that. But there's a grain of truth. Now, even a broken clock strikes correctly twice a day. And the point being is dumping $50 billion in charity, it ought to be done because of the incredible starvation and epidemic disease and what have you, and wars sweeping that continent. Is that the people that were ultimately responsible for it in the 19th and 20th century ought to pay some, to be sure. And the United States didn't have any colonies over there. But the European powers, I mean, that's how they gained their wealth. They gained their wealth through looting. I mean, looting is an extraordinarily big part of national economies, right? I mean, you've heard me say this before. We looted this continent from its native people. We looted slaves from Africa. And we looted their labor free. And then for another few hundred years of so-called free labor, we looted the amount of the value that was produced by this incredible productivity and rewarded so poorly. Then at some point, 1930s, people said, hey, we ought to get a little of this back. We're working our butts off. We're getting, terrible conditions. And so, they raised the standard of living here a bit. Well, it's starting to go the other way again, and we're seeing that 19th century mentality beginning to develop again. And that's what the Bush administration would like, us to go back to the 19th century, where labor is super exploited, where there's no such thing as unions, where laws requiring corporations to protect its workers and the population from pollution, those are all gone. That's against the free market. I mean, that's their idea of freedom, a market that screws people. Anyways, so there is so much poverty in the world amidst so much wealth being centered in the hands of so few people. Do I still have that? I mean, it's really small. I mean, it doesn't matter how many people are dying. could be that about 3 million kids are going to die in Africa real soon, even if they put all these, send $50 billion in aid. But maybe it is on the bottom here. Here it is. 691 people on Earth have over $2 trillion. $2 trillion. $2.2 trillion. 691 people. And which means, essentially, that if you took... that's who should be paying. Why should you and I, and why should a citizen of Germany and France and Italy and England, who are already taxed highly, why should we have to pay for the damage that has been done to these countries, where you have people that have such extraordinary wealth that 691 people control $2.2 trillion? If we gave each of these people $1 billion, that would be 691 billion. They'd be billionaires. They'd have more money than they knew what to do with, because no one can spend $1 billion. They could buy all the politicians that they have historically, so that wouldn't change politically. We're just talking about 3 million kids not dying. We're talking about ending genocide in Darfur. We're talking about ending AIDS in Africa. So give these people $1 billion, take the rest of it. There's these conservatives saying, he wants to take their money. I'd say 3 million kids are going to die in Africa. It's nothing. They go back to doing whatever they're doing. I say, leave these people with $1 billion. What a commie I am. I want to take all their money from them and leave them only with $1 billion. They can buy their islands and their yachts. They can buy their politicians, and they can get $400 haircuts and all that, just like they always did. Because they can't use $2.2 trillion. 691 people can't spend it. So it turns out to be cyber wealth. So it's like having food that other people are starving and you're preserving food even though you don't need it. Or something like that. All right, we'll be right back.
You're listening to WRIF.com.
Hey, Tigers fans, this summer, why sit at home when you could sit at home? Fight, that is. Now is a great time to catch all the fun and excitement happening at every Detroit Tigers home game. You'll see plenty of homers by Pudge Rodriguez, Dimitri Young, Carlos Guillen, and all your favorite players. But a trip to Comerica Park means more than just baseball. While the Tigers are driving home runs, you could drive home in a brand new car during the Chevy Cobalt Drive One Home Giveaway, sponsored by your Detroit area Chevy dealers. Just buy a ticket to select Friday or Saturday night home games, and you could drive one out of here. Looking for a surefire hit? Hey, don't miss Friday and Saturday night fireworks sponsored by Pepsi and Verizon Wireless. And with a weekend value pack, that's four tickets, four hot dogs, and four Pepsis for just $59. Hey, you'll want to bring everyone from home. So for great giveaways like autographed balls, bobbleheads, collector cards, and jerseys, and for great baseball, this summer, catch a Tigers game. For tickets, call 248-25-TIGER or visit DetroitTigers.com and make Comerica Park your home away from home game.
Anglers, get ready to cast your line for big money. The OSI Pro Series WRAF Great Lakes Fishing Championship Series is underway, and there's still time to enter to win the $1,500 Series Championship. Sign up now for the Bass Championship going out of Lake Erie Metro Park on July 30th. Slots will fill up fast, so get your entry in now. Compete for thousands of dollars in cash and prizes, including the DMF Bait Award for the Canada 16 landing the largest fish on live bait. It's all going to be given away to the best fishing team in town, so sign up now by calling 248-591-6841 or go to WRIF.com for an entry form. There will be fun for everyone at the post-event party at Big Al Sports Grill, so call 248-591-6841 to become the OSI Pro Series WRIF Great Lakes Fishing Series champion. Call 248-591-6841 today. Brought to you by OSI Pro Series, the DMF Bait Company, Big Al Sports Grill, and 101 WRIF.
Want to get to the next level of your career? If working harder at your job won't help, work smarter by earning a bachelor's or master's degree at University of Phoenix. the nation's largest accredited private university. It's college designed for busy working adults. In most cases, you can earn a degree in only 2 to 3 years. To find out how, call 1-800-664-1391. At the University of Phoenix Detroit campus, the small classes are designed for working adults with busy lives. You'll cover more material in less time with convenient classes in the evening or on the weekend. At University of Phoenix, you can do this. Call now for a brochure on degree programs in business, technology, nursing, education, and more. 1-800-664-1391. Programs vary by campus. Call University of Phoenix now. 1-800-664-1391. That's 1-800-664-1391. And now, a word from the Riff Legal Eagles. Unless otherwise stated, all entrants for WRIF contests must be at least 18 years of age and a legal resident of the United States. A household is eligible to win one contest per 30 days every 6 months for prizes valued at $600 or higher. Greater Media Detroit and its affiliates, promotional sponsors, advertising and promotional agencies, and other radio and television stations in the Detroit ADI are not eligible to participate. One entry per person. No purchase or other consideration is necessary to participate in the contest. Void where prohibited. Prizes are non-transferable or redeemable for cash. 101 WRIF reserves the right to substitute any prize for one of equal or greater value. By participating in the contest, contestants consent to the broadcast and or publication of their name, voice, face, and or likeness without compensation. Participants listening online at www.wrif.com may receive audio that is delayed by as much as 60 seconds later than the over-the-air transmission, which could potentially affect chances of winning. General contest rules are available online at www.wrif.com or during regular business hours at the WRIF Studios, 1 Radio Plaza, Detroit, Michigan, 48220.
This is WRIF.com.
Night Call is back on 101 WRIF Detroit. Here's your host, Peter Werby.
Thank you very much. 313-298-WRIF is the last segment of our program for this Sunday. At 1 a.m. Eastern Time, we're going to be doing a couple of interviews. Actually, someone could say to me, what do I have, a mouse in my pocket? Why we? I will play this interview that I did earlier. One about all these, just amazing. I'm always just amazed how many people in our entertainment industry have addiction problems. So we're going to talk a bit about that with someone who's written a book. And also a repeat of a show I did before going to Cuba with a person that wrote the definitive guidebook about the island. And I guess Hurricane Dennis people were prepared, didn't get hit quite as badly as they thought. And also, as I said, the preparations made people reduced no fatalities and reduced property damage, although it did kill 10 people in Cuba and did great damage to a city I visited, Cienfuegos. It was very sad. I mean, just like I'd been in London and think, yeah, I was on those subways. And same thing, I was walking down those streets in Cienfuegos, you just see all these collapsed telephone poles. It's always kind of shocking. And we were, because this is the nature of the show, we always wind up talking about the political aspects of situations like this London bombing. But what I should have really asked at the beginning, how do you feel as a person, as in living your life with, you know, you're like your family, or what you see is the future? I mean, are we going to have to be like people in Israel, or how Britain was during the IRA attacks, or what have you? I don't know. I guess maybe it's too late to ask that question, but if you want to comment on it, I'd like to hear it. Here's Pete listening in Windsor. Pete, hi. You're on the air.
Hey, Pete. It's Pete over here.
Great.
How's it going over there?
It's going great over here.
Hey, listen, I have a comment, actually, for that we just said right there.
Sure.
Terrorism, my friend, is just like how Darwin put it.
What's that?
It's like an evolutionary process.
Uh-huh.
How an organism begins to survive in its own environment and then spreads out to other environments, infecting them and eventually conquering them. And I'm not saying that terrorism is going to conquer anything, but I'm saying that it's spreading out right now. You know, it's not going to be contained in the Middle East like we would like to believe, you know, how the media tells us that it's only over there and it's never going to come into our country. But unfortunately, the fact of the matter is that these bastards will find a way, you know, and it's inevitability that it's going to come to us. And really, we can't do anything about it. I guess the best thing we can do is basically tuck our heads under our knees and kiss our asses goodbye.
Sure.
Things don't change, you know what I mean?
Yeah, yeah.
Right now, I think the biggest terrorism on this planet really is American ignorance on the outside world. Do you know what I mean? Especially since America itself controls about 25% of the world's wealth by itself without sharing it. I mean, you want to end poverty in Africa, why don't you share some of that percentage, you know what I mean?
Well, I do, Pete, and here, I think it's time for me to speak for other people that are listening, but I always suspect Americans hear that and they go, wait a minute, they want to take more of my money. But what we got to realize is the disproportionate distribution of income that privileges a small, small sector of the population here in the United States and around the world, that if all these funds were freed up and they weren't centered and controlled by just this small, greedy, selfish, powerful elite, 99% of these problems would just disappear.
Yeah, well, I would like to disagree with that. I don't think that the problems will really disappear. I mean, honestly, people get greedy anyways. I don't think there's a way that we can win this war.
Well, here, what I mean by how greed can control, you control it through, I mean, if you just allow dog-eat-dog, well, the more aggressive dogs, maybe even the more, I don't even think it's more intelligent dogs. It's the greediest and the most assertive and aggressive dogs that wind up on top. And without regulation of it, that's what you wind up with. So you wind up with people at the top having this intense privilege, having everything they could want, plus, and you have the people at the bottom, which now begins to total in the billions of people at the bottom, suffering great deprivation. All right, Pete, thanks for making our show international. Appreciate it. Talk to you soon, I hope. Let's go way down to North Carolina and talk to Bruce. Bruce, hi, you're on the air.
Hey, Pete, greetings from the Southern contingent and the war on conservatism.
Okay, welcome.
You know, I just listened to the explanation that you gave there regarding the world's wealth, and I think that's a perfectly apt way of putting that. But, you know, kind of what I wanted to it just amazed me, the statistic you just gave about the 691 people owning $3 trillion, did you say?
$2.2 trillion, yeah.
$2.2 trillion of the world's wealth. It's just appalling.
Add that to the fact that $1 trillion a year is spent on armaments, with the United States spending half of what is spent in the entire world, and we can't lick guys in Iraq who I read an interview with who said they prefer to fight barefoot.
They prefer to fight barefoot.
Yeah, guys, I don't know why. Guys said, they said, why don't you have any shoes on? He says, I prefer to fight barefoot.
perhaps our own freedom fighters, 250 years ago, thought the same thing.
Maybe.
But you know, the other thing too is that, you know, I wanted to comment a little bit on the supposed war on terror. I really see the war on terror itself as being more and more like the war on poverty and the war on drugs, in that it's a great way to play to the base for the conservatives. It's a great way to present a specter without a real name and a real face. You know, it's a great way to drum up the troops and to drum up the patriotism without actually ever winning anything. And, you know, it's my feeling that this supposed war on terror really doesn't, if you look at it very deeply, you know, we're not fighting that. We're fighting something else entirely in Iraq. Actually, we're doing an occupation there.
Well, it works to the benefit, of course, to people in power to have a so-called war on terror, which is not a war on terror. I mean, that's sort of a phrase that got into popular usage to show that we're going to give this great effort. We're going to have a war on drugs. Of course, it never is won, but we take billions and billions and billions of dollars to make criminals out of our citizens and create a prison industrial complex and what have you. In the same way with the war on terror, it justifies Bush's political leadership for a while, gave him great poll ratings till he, you know, dropped down to probably as low as you can go. And it also is a justification for the continuing spending of now trillions of dollars for a war that you can't possibly fight with modern weaponry. You don't need jet planes when you got your adversaries getting on subway cars and dropping off knapsacks.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, and it's, you know, the last thing I wanted to mention too also is you know, doing a shout out to the Tom Hartman chat room.
Okay, we should do that. In fact, I didn't say that tonight. Tom Hartman, you can just go to tomhartman.com. Tom Hartman, really the hardest working man in talk radio. And if you go to his website, you'll understand why. And he lets us use his chat room during this 2 hours that we do this talk show. Love, Tom. All right, Bruce, thanks for calling in from North Carolina. Let's get another state. Here is Ed in Toledo. Ed, it's Peter Werby. Thanks for your patience.
Hey, Pete, how you doing?
Doing great.
I called about this alleged war on drugs. Earlier this week, the National Sheriff's Association came out and said that this methamphetamine problem is bankrupting their departments. Meanwhile, Chimpy's administration just says, no, we have 15 million people in America who smoke pot. That's the real enemy. And I'll be the first one to admit that methamphetamine is really some bad stuff.
Well, it is. You're right. They, besides saying that it's bankrupting their departments, they also said that meth is the worst drug problem in America. In the meantime, as you said, Bush is still saying it's marijuana. And all the other drugs, heroin, cocaine, crack, that is just paling. People are just doing meth. I guess it's the perfect drug for America.
Yeah, well, you know, I figure if you give the sheeple, you know, another NASCAR race or another American Idol show, it'd take their minds off the real criminals on the Potomac.
Well, I'll tell you, long ago and far away, I saw a meth freak, and what he did to himself physically and psychologically, and talk about something that was a big enough warning that it never even occurred to me to get anywhere near that stuff.
I heard that, you know, but... yeah, this country's got their priorities all screwed up with this moron we got in the White House. I think the reason they didn't tell him about the airplane approaching the airspace was they probably just took his training wheels off and they didn't want him crashing.
There you go. Thank you, Ed. Thanks for calling in from Toledo. Here is Robert in Clarkston. Hi, Robert. You're on the air.
Peter, love the show.
Thank you.
Well, I'd just like to talk about the strategic placement of the United States in between Saudi Arabia and Iran.
Uh-huh.
And the long-term effects that might play on us and the oil in that region. See, I'm not for this war in Iraq because the conservatives are robbing the states of our money. I mean, my university is getting cut 10% next year. They're talking about cutting the budget 30% over the next 6 years. And that's just appalling to me. Our universities are our top priority. 10% next year. So, but back to the strategic placement of the United States in between Saudi Arabia and Iran. I was just wondering if you had thoughts on that.
Well, you know, you almost, just asking the question almost answers it. I mean, the answer to this increasingly scarce resource, that is oil, is to occupy a region 6,000 miles from our home. And all you got to do, and I've mentioned this book so many times over the years, go to the conservative historian Paul Kennedy. And I think I always get the name of this book wrong, but it's something like The Rise and Fall of the Great Empires, the Great Nations. And he talks about how Britain, Portugal, Spain, the Netherlands all overextended themselves through the attempt on armaments and then supply of regions so far from their home district. And actually, the guy that put together the Spielberg movie, War of the Worlds, the latest incarnation, he said that in a way is a kind of a parable for what's happening. This all-powerful, technologically seemingly unstoppable military force, comes and gets defeated by the people who you would think would be no match for them. I mean, how do the Vietnamese defeat us? How come we can't beat Iraq?
But going back to the communist days, you think this is, we're trying to break up the Muslim fundamentalists possibly? And
the Muslim what?
Muslim fundamentalists.
Well, there's a lot of players in the Middle East. I mean, the Muslim fundamentalists, if you look at what they're saying, I mean, they're saying that the United States supports the worst and most corrupt dictators in the Middle East. Well, that's true. You know, we support the Saudis, we support Egypt, we support all these oil emirates, we support Kuwait. You know, I mean, these people are the farthest thing from democracy, but what they have is either oil or they have strategic military positions like Egypt. All right, I am almost out of time, so I'm going to say goodbye and thank you for raising those questions. Those are so important to raise and to answer for ourselves. Thank you for it. All right, our final call is Stan from Macomb. Stan, Peter Werby, you're on the air. Stan, are you with me? Oh. Is that it? All right. Jay Hudson is the producer, and he just, boom, everybody gone. All right, he's right. It's time to go. Although, I just saw this news item. It's according to, well, let me just read it for you. Britain and the U.S. are trying to build a new strategy to exit Iraq that could see British troops leaving the country by Christmas, according to a newspaper citing a government memo written by the defense secretary. It's the Mail on Sunday reported that British Defense Secretary John Reid drafted a secret paper for Prime Minister Tony Blair outlining how most of the country's 8,500 troops could be sent home from Iraq within 3 months, with the rest by the end of the year. Well, that's all good and well, but the United States does not have an exit strategy because it does not intend to exit. This wasn't a war to get rid of weapons of mass destruction, as we all know now, and it wasn't for bringing democracy anywhere. It was about control of the oil under Iraq and control of oil in that region. And you have a, right now, we are paying for, it hasn't even begun to be built, but a $1 billion embassy there and permanent bases in the country. So they ain't talking about getting out. It's a shame. All right, thank you so much for listening and for calling. Stay tuned for the interviews.
This is WRIM.com.
Bill Bonds with a commercial. If you're near or far-sighted and you want to throw away those glasses forever, I know a doctor you should see. Dr. Escombati. Phone number 1-877. Then the letters U-S-E-E-M-O-R-E. 1-877-U-C-MORE. The equipment, the finest high-tech equipment ever made. Price $999 per eye. So don't fall for those $200 prices you hear being tossed around on the radio. Cows don't fly. Neither do those prices, unless your daddy is an eye doctor and you're getting a freebie. Dr. S. Combati, no doctor we know of has a better success rate. Procedure is fast, safe, cost $999 per eye. Virtually painless, you're in and out, maybe 40 minutes. Procedure itself, maybe 5. When it's over, you'll want to kiss your glasses goodbye and hug the doctor. Or maybe you guys will just want to give him a high-five. Shake hands with them, walk away, and see a whole new world. See you.
Every day, employers search for people skilled in today's technology. Are you ready for a change to a new career? Make a difference for yourself by calling the ITT Technical Institutes at 1-800-396-6622. Find out how an ITT Tech can help you prepare for a career in electronics, information technology, or drafting and design. Nationwide, thousands have launched technical careers after graduating from an ITT Tech. Classes meet just a few times a week to help you balance school and your job. Financial aid is available for those who qualify, and career assistance is available once you graduate. Now is your chance to make a difference for yourself, to start a new path to a career involving technology. Find out what an ITT Tech education can offer you. Call 1-800-396-6622 for an ITT Tech brochure. Classes are forming now, so call ITT Tech at 1-800-396-6622. That's 1-800-396-6622.
And now, a word from the Riff Legal Eagles. Unless otherwise stated, all entrants for WRIF contests must be at least 18 years of age and a legal resident of the United States. A household is eligible to win one contest per 30 days every 6 months for prices valued at $600 or higher. Greater Media Detroit and its affiliates, promotional sponsors, advertising and promotional agencies, and other radio and television stations in the Detroit ADI are not eligible to participate. One entry per person. No purchase or other consideration is necessary to participate in the contest. Void where prohibited. Prices are not transferable or redeemable for cash. 101 WRIF reserves the right to substitute any prize for one of equal or greater value. By participating in the contest, contestants consent to the broadcast and or publication of their name, voice, face, and or likeness without compensation. Participants listening online at www.wrif.com may receive audio that is delayed by as much as 60 seconds later than the over-the-air transmission, which could potentially affect chances of winning. General contest rules are available online at www.wrif.com or during regular business hours at the WRIF Studios, 1 Radio Plaza, Detroit, Michigan, 48220.
You're listening to WRIF.com.
Back with more Night Call on 101 WRIF Detroit. Here's Peter Werby.
Thank you very much for joining me, Jim Hughes. Thank you for the introduction. Peter Werbe here with you, and another discussion here on the broadcast about drugs, drug abuse, drug use, and in fact, this time, more about drug abuse. The book is The Harder They Fall, Celebrities Tell Their Real-Life Stories of Addiction and Recovery. It's by Gary Stromberg and Jane Merrill. And Gary Stromberg, in 1967, co-founded one of the most successful public relations firms in the entertainment business. He represented music industry superstars such as the Rolling Stones, Pink Floyd, Elton John, The Doors, Earth, Wind, and Fire. And he co-produced, remember that motion picture Car Wash? Man, I can still hear some of the music. Gary Stromberg hit bottom, like so many of the people in the book, The Harder They Fall. And Peter Werbe here interviewing Gary Stromberg. Gary, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Peter. It's a pleasure to be with you today.
You know, I just wrote down, I hope I didn't say that, I wrote down your website. It's theharderthefall.com, right?
Yes.
Okay. Yeah. That's the old, Jimmy Cliff song.
Jimmy Cliff song, of course.
And
Humphrey Bogart movie.
Oh, that's right. And I put down the first line, which I will not mention again to confuse all of us. So it's theharderthefall.com. I was very taken with a lot of the stories in here by the by famous our musicians, our politicians, our comics, our boxers. And yet you, Gary Stromberg, had a pretty incredible story of your own. I was very taken with that in the introduction. Maybe you could just give us that in short form and tell us how this led into this book.
Sure, I'd be happy to. As you mentioned, in the late 60s, I started what was to become a very successful entertainment-based PR firm and represented pretty much a who's who of who was that was happening in contemporary music during those years. And in addition to the very exciting and volatile work that I was involved in, I developed a substance abuse problem, as did many of my clients. The drugs and alcohol kind of permeated my existence during those years, and I was no different than many of the people I knew, and got hooked and continued using for many years. And in some ways, as I look back on those years, it was kind of instrumental in the success that I had, because all of these musicians were, you know, and I shouldn't say all musicians, many musicians that I worked with were partial to drugs and substances, and because I was a user and willing participant, it made my company more desirable to them because I was one of them.
So you were getting high with all the greats.
I was getting high in the short story. Yes,
yeah.
I was getting high with these people that I represented, and that worked very well for me for a long time. But then, as is the way, and it's certainly the way you hear in the stories that are recounted in the book, drugs stopped working for me at some point, and rather than taking them to get high, I was taking them to maintain, and then eventually I was just taking them because I had to.
Louis Lapham, how do you say his name?
Lapham,
yeah. Louis Lapham, editor of Harper's Magazine. It's funny, I've seen his name so many times, and he's actually, how is he described here as probably the foremost public intellectual as
yes.
well. Yeah, and that he is. And he speculates on what this was all about. What was there about the music scene, the 60s and the 70s, that led so many people down the wrong road?
Well, Lewis is very eloquent in the book describing his thoughts about it. And my own belief is that that artists in particular and people that rose to the level of achievement that these people did are risk takers. They are people who are exploring their talents and their creativity, and that takes courage. And oft times that in order to enhance the experience or to prop themselves up, people relied on substances. I mean, no, in my own case, even though I wasn't an artist, when I started taking drugs, it kind of fulfilled all the things that I wanted in me that I thought were lacking. You know, it made me handsomer. It made me more talkative. It gave me liquid courage. And I thought I was, you know, performing at a much higher level, excuse the pun, when I was high.
And that's, you know, I found to be the case in almost all of these people. And there's also a tradition in the arts amongst about substance abuse. You know, I was a big jazz fan in those years. And, you know, you never hear about a jazz musician that wasn't high during a performance. It just seemed to go hand in hand. And certainly there's that tradition exists in rock and roll, and it exists in creative writing, and exists on the stage. So, you know, the people coming up in those professions naturally would gravitate towards drugs as being a natural part of the, you know, the work.
Mm-hmm. Gary Schomburg, it's funny that you mentioned jazz. In fact, I just got a new LP turntable. I'm playing some of these 50-year-old discs that I have, and I was listening to Charlie Parker, The Bird, and I remember reading stories about him that sometimes he was so strung out on heroin during recording sessions that he had to be propped up by people at the session so he could play his solos. Yet they are and remain legendary.
I'll tell you an interesting story. That Nile Rodgers, the wonderful R&B musician and producer, you know, from the group Chic, who produced many of the seminal rock acts of the 70s, 80s, and so forth, is one of the people I interviewed in the book. And he was raised in Greenwich Village, and his parents were both junkies. And he reports in the book that as a child, he believed that only children slept laying down, because when he would come home from school, his parents and their friends would be there nodding out, either standing up or sitting down. And he thought that that's how they slept, and that only children slept while laying down.
Well, I think that's a good explanation about, as we were saying earlier, about artists and that incredible drive that they have. Also, as you said, the tradition of different kind of intoxications within the artistic community. What about the idea that at least either Lewis Lapham or the other person who has written one of the introductions,
Stephen Davis,
yeah, who talks about no limits during that period?
That's correct.
Yeah.
Yeah, this was this in my world as a young man coming up at that time, it was all about exploration. You know, I read a book by Aldous Huxley when I started fooling around with psychedelics. And in the book, The Doors of Perception, Huxley refers to people who experimented with drugs as being inner astronauts exploring inner space.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember thinking to myself during that time, wow, that sounds great. I think that, you know, that could be a career potential for me, you know, being an inner astronaut. So, yeah, this was all exploratory stuff that we were doing at the time, and we were not aware of any of the consequences. I mean, I remember that cocaine was not thought to be addictive, you know, and then the information started to come out to the contrary, and they were suggesting at worst it might be psychologically addicting.
Right, but habituative.
Yeah.
So
you know, there was nothing really to be afraid of, you know, when we started experimenting and using drugs.
I think most people probably know, but maybe we shouldn't just repeat it quickly, that Aldous Huxley's book, The Doors of Perception, is where the band The Doors got their name. So you
That's
see
correct.
That
yeah.
connection
yeah.
You know, pretty early on.
It was pretty solid.
What about the youth factor? Here you have suddenly people, teenagers, early 20s, getting fame and fortune and the ability. We're talking about no limits, but certainly a lot more of the limits are taken off of these star performers than even the rest of the youth of that era. And also having just, I'm sorry, I kind of cut you off, but I was also thinking the fact that these were people that were 19, 20 years old, and suddenly they're like world renowned, and how the hell
and
do you deal with that? Yeah, and millionaires.
Yeah, I remember one of the acts that I represent, I don't remember who, but commented to me that the first airplane ride he ever took, he flew first class, you know, and where do you go from there? And that's very true. There were no limits. And in fact, worse than no limits, there were enablers, because the people who were profiting from these talented young people and watching them, you know, get addicted to drugs, didn't step in any way to counter it, because these people were their meal tickets. There's a terrific story, and one of my favorites in the book is the Chuck Negron story, who Chuck, as you may know, was the lead singer in Three Dog Night, which,
sure,
who was arguably one of the most successful rock bands of the early 70s. They had a string of hits that was unrivaled at the time. I think they had 19 top 10 records in a row. And Chuck went from being in this band, being, you know, having every material success that you could possibly manage, money, fame, fortune, and he went from there to living in a cardboard box in Skid Row in downtown Los Angeles.
Wow.
You know, and
that's incredible.
And I represented Three Dog Night, and there was nothing that anybody could do that could curtail his drug use or his ultimate demise. And I remember once they toured. They were the first group that ever toured exclusively in football stadiums. They did an entire summer tour of football stadiums, you know, 75 to 100,000 seats, selling out concert after concert. And the very first night of the tour was in Dallas, Texas, 1972, if I'm correct. And Chuck got into an automobile accident because he was high, and he broke his arm and he broke his nose, and he was just totally banged up. He was taken to the hospital, and he was a mess. And his management went in and secreted him out of the hotel, out of the hospital, and took him to the arena to perform that night, because they didn't want to lose that payday. And Chuck's, you know, there are pictures, many pictures of him on stage that night with both of his eyes are blackened, nose broken, his arm in a cast. He can barely stand up. He's propped up on every kind of painkiller you could imagine. And they, you know, they delivered him there so they wouldn't miss that payday.
Well, my guest is Gary Stromberg, along with Jane Merrill. He's written The Harder They Fall, Celebrities Tell Their Real Life Stories of Addiction and Recovery. We're not really doing this sequentially, but I want to get back to your personal story as well, but we ought to introduce the people that are in The Harder They Fall as well. How did you, I've seen books like this before, so this is not new, stars telling about their fall and their recovery. Why did Gary Stromberg decide to put this together?
Well, recovery has been the kind of the cornerstone of my life for the last almost 23 years now. And I've been very dedicated and involved in my own recovery and the recovery of others. It's been, you know, recovery saved my life. I mean, I was headed towards death. And I've been able through, you know, my own efforts and grace and to live a wonderful life in recovery. And I know many others that are. And a couple of years ago, I got kind of the itch to write. And I was given encouragement mainly by my partner, Jane Merrill, to pursue a book. And it occurred to me that telling my story wouldn't be that, you know, important, but that the one thing I could contribute beyond my story was my access to many of the celebrities that I knew who were in recovery. And so I started off to tell their story, and my background is almost exclusively in music, although I've been involved in the film business a little bit as well. But I thought, well, as long as I'm going to involve celebrities, I might as well expand the horizon a little bit to include people in sports, people in politics, writers, and you know, I've got comedians, and you know, I've got a pretty wide range of people who were famous. All of who have in common, by the way, that they rose to fame during the 60s and 70s, my generation, crashed and burned, and then have been in recovery for at least 10 years. So all of these people have really remarkable stories of redemption to tell and do tell in the book.
Now, some of these people like Grace Slick and Alice Cooper and Richard Pryor are famously in recovery.
Yes.
And they probably were easy to find out or say, oh, yeah, I got to go get them. How did these other people respond to the offer to be in the book, and how did you know that they were in recovery?
Well, that's the answer to your first part of your question. People who are in recovery and have been in recovery for the length of time that all of these people were very willing to tell their stories. A big part of recovery is the willing to share and help others, and it's a responsibility that we carry. You know, I liken the recovery that we have to people who survived the Titanic. I mean, we were headed for an awful fate, and somehow miraculously when the ship went down, we were spared. We're sitting in lifeboats, you know, and we look around and the ship went down and there we are. And people who are in that circumstance become enormously grateful and recognize the responsibility of sharing that gift. So the people that I were, you know, when I did identify and contact the people that I wanted for the book, almost unanimously they all readily agreed, with just a couple of exceptions. And primarily the exceptions were people who wanted to save their story for their own books at some later date. So nobody really objected to the idea of doing.
You know, I was just at a media conference in Bowling Green, Ohio, and I was at a workshop about interviewing, and I remember one of the don'ts was don't ask multiple questions, and I did that because I asked, were these people willing? And then I said, how did you find out? I mean, some of these people that are probably not as well known in terms of their addiction, at least Malcolm McDowell and Steve Earle, others like that,
there's a fraternity that exists in the recovery community. So, when I would talk to somebody that was that I interviewed for the book, I would ask them if they had any other ideas, and I pretty much knew, I was aware. Steve Earle I didn't know about. There's a few people in the book that I didn't know about. But as I pursued, as I started investigating certain areas, other people were revealed to me. And it really was kind of an interesting journey just finding the various people to pursue. Pat Day, for instance, the Hall of Fame jockey, I didn't know was in recovery, but I knew another jockey was in recovery, and I started to go after him, and I couldn't get to him. And then somebody said, why don't you try Pat Day? He's in recovery, too. So I was able to get to Pat Day.
Now, this is maybe an odd question. I mean, since I'm always have been a moderate imbiber, whatever the word is.
Yes.
And if someone said, well, gee, I couldn't drink wine anymore, I'd say, well, it's kind of a loss in my life. So drugs played this enormous role in your life. Is there ever in your life, say, gee, I sort of wish I could. Is it that pull? Is that still there?
Sure, and it's something you need to be aware of the rest of your life. Every day, there's not a day goes by where at some point during the day something says to me that you have to be diligent, that you have to be mindful of certain things that are occurring in your life. You know, I had sushi for lunch this afternoon, and the next table over, people were not only eating sushi, but they were having sake, which I know goes very well with sushi, but I can't do that. But it's very easy for me to look at that sake and know that if I started drinking that sake, I wouldn't sit like those people were and have one glass of sake. You know, I'd drink the bottle, and then I'd be out, emptying the bar, and then I'd be on my phone to my Coke dealer, and then, who knows where I'd end up. So it's not hard for me to follow the drink through to where it led me, and then I make a conscious decision not to take that first drink.
How did people get into recovery? Is it a different? Is it different for each person? In other words, a lot of people will go into 12-step programs. Other people, and I've read, I don't know what the statistics are, but it said the vast majority of people that are abusing alcohol or drugs quit on their own. So it's a matter of willpower, pretty much. I mean, people in my family never were that were alcohol abusers. Actually, they just said, I'm ruining my life. I'm ruining my health. I'm stopping. Some people need
reinforcement.
That reinforcement.
Of a program,
yeah.
Sure.
Is everyone that you interviewed, are they in programs, or did some of them just stop by themselves?
A variety. It goes the whole gamut. There are people who stopped by themselves. There are people who have had a spiritual awakening. The jockey Pat Day that I was referring to was drunk in a hotel room after he had just won the national riding championship. He had been out celebrating, and he was drunk in a hotel room and feeling very depressed. And he was flipping through the stations on the television thing, and he saw a televangelist come on, and he fell to his knees, accepted Jesus as his Lord, and has been sober ever since, and never looked back. You know, and that's an unusual conversion, but he had, for him, which was a real spiritual awakening that night, and as I said, never looked back. There are others that are in 12-step programs. There are others that are doing it on their own. There's a variety of it. But the thing that is in common, which is I think you were alluding to at the beginning of that question, was what's common in their deciding to get into recovery. recovery, and there is a consistent thing in all of these stories and in everyone who's in recovery, and that is hitting a bottom. And that bottom can be there's a whole variety of bottoms that people hit. They can be a material bottom, it can be a spiritual bottom, it can be an emotional bottom. But at some point you look in yourself in the mirror and you say, I can't do this anymore, you know, and that's when recovery becomes possible.
The book is The Harder They Fall, Celebrities Tell Their Real-Life Stories of Addiction and Recovery. Gary Stromberg is my guest. He's co-author with Jane Merrill, a foreword by Lewis Lapham, editor of Harper's Magazine. Website is theharderthefall.com. It'll be on my website, peterwerby.com, as well. I think of some of the stories of my abusive friends, and I tell this because, it was told to me almost for laughs, but I can imagine what was really going on. A friend of ours, a woman, woke up on Sunday morning, looked over, there was some guy that she was sharing the bed with. She had no idea who he was, how she or he had gotten there. She got her clothes, had her purse, got her keys, walked outside, and she thought, where the hell is my car? Actually found it there, then realized she did not know where on the planet she was.
Oh,
she had to ask someone, where am I? And they said, tell me where I am. And that was it. I mean, it was that dramatic. You talk about, the gates of hell are yawning wide. And is there usually that dramatic single incident?
No, there isn't. It just, in my own personal case, the accumulation of the lies and deception and people that I was hurting in my life and the losing all of the material things that I'd worked hard for, the accumulation of all of those circumstances ultimately led to my recovery. But there wasn't one, lightning didn't strike me, and I didn't lose one thing that got me into recovery. And I think that, again, it varies from case to case. I knew a man in the town that I live in, Westport, Connecticut, that hit his bottom by falling off his yacht one day. And he hadn't lost anything materially, and he was still, doing very well as the rest of the world saw it. But he just recognized that he was out of control from his drinking and that he had to stop. And that was, for him what his bottom was. Other people like Chuck Negron, who ride the train of alcoholism and drug addiction, almost to the very end, end up living in boxes. So you can't really tell.
Well, in terms of telling, just listening to your voice, Gary Stromberg, you have this settled sense or this this sense of yourself. I mean, you've lost a lot. I mean, you've tumbled pretty far. You've come up some. You have your own agency again in Connecticut. Do you ever kick yourself and think, how the hell did I blow all this? I mean,
there's a curious thing that exists, and again, these stories are told in my book. Many of the people reflect the same thing that I'm about to tell you, but I paid a terrible price to get into recovery, as did the people that are in my book. We pay a terrible price. We hurt ourselves. We hurt the people we love. We hurt our careers. We just wreak havoc in our lives. But because of the devastation that I caused in my life, I have tremendous capability of doing good and helping people. I am in many respects a beacon of light to people who are suffering from this disease. They see me, and I don't mean to, sound my own horn here, but they see me as somebody who has recovered or is in recovery, who has put his life back together and can serve as an example. And so I work with a lot of other men that are in recovery that need somebody to say to them, you're going to be all right. And if you do what I did, maybe you can get through this disease as well. So what I'm saying is that the price that I paid, as I look back now in 23 years of recovery, was worth it, because I have a tremendous capacity to do good and help other people. And there's nothing that I would exchange that for.
As this show airs on Sunday, what would you suggest that people do on Monday that are having problems with drugs? Where should they turn? What should they do?
Oh, there's all kinds of help available for people. The key thing is here, it's not so much of what should they do and where should they go, because anybody that wants it can find it. There are all kinds of 12-step programs. If you're suffering from alcohol addiction, just call Alcoholics Anonymous. It's in the phone book. There's all kinds of rehab. There's all kinds of therapy, private therapy. There's no shortage of help available. But the thing that I would encourage people to do that's more important than finding that recovery or finding the way to the recovery is to look at themselves and to become willing to to change, to become willing to not use anymore, become willing to live a different kind of life. That's the thing that takes real courage and real conviction. Because unless you have that, you're not going to get it.
Yeah, people are frightened that they can't change.
Oh,
I've known
sure.
people like that. And sometimes people fall back, and that's the proof to them that they are worthless, that they are hopeless drug addicts. And I think a lot of the stories in this book, The Harder They Fall, celebrities tell their real-life stories of addiction and recovery, would be real encouragement if you're having problems, if you're not. Just the pathos in the story, even some of the humor, like from Richard Pryor and his story, are worth the read alone. Gary Stromberg has been my guest. He's written The Harder They Fall, along with Jane Merrill, forward by Lewis Lapham, editor of Harper's Magazine. And you can go to theharderthefall.com. Gary Stromberg, thanks for joining me on The Peter Werbe Show.
Peter, it was my pleasure. I really enjoyed this.
You're listening to WRIF.com.
And now, a word from the Riff Legal Eagles. Unless otherwise stated, all entrants for WRIF contests must be at least 18 years of age and a legal resident of the United States. A household is eligible to win one contest per 30 days every 6 months for prizes valued at $600 or higher. Greater Media Detroit and its affiliates, promotional sponsors, advertising and promotional agencies, and other radio and television stations in the Detroit ADI are not eligible to participate. One entry per person. No purchase or other consideration is necessary to participate in the contest. Void where prohibited. Prizes are non-transferable or redeemable for cash. 101 WRIF reserves the right to substitute any prize for one of equal or greater value. By participating in the contest, contestants consent to the broadcast and or publication of their name, voice, face, and or likeness without compensation. Participants listening online at www.wrif.com may receive audio that is delayed by as much as 60 seconds later than the over-the-air transmission, which could potentially affect chances of winning. General contest rules are available online at www.wrif.com or during regular business hours at the WRIF Studios, 1 Radio Plaza, Detroit, Michigan, 482.
Every day, employers search for people skilled in today's technology. Are you ready for a change to a new career? Make a difference for yourself by calling the ITT Technical Institutes at 1-800-396-6622. Find out how an ITT Tech can help you prepare for a career in electronics, information technology, or drafting and design. Nationwide, thousands have launched technical careers after graduating from an ITT Tech. Classes meet just a few times a week to help you balance school and your job. Financial aid is available for those who qualify, and career assistance is available once you graduate. Now is your chance to make a difference for yourself, to start a new path to a career involving technology. Find out what an ITT Tech education can offer you. Call 1-800-396-6622 for an ITT Tech brochure. Classes are forming now, so call ITT Tech at 1-800-396-6622. That's 1-800-396-6622.
Hey, Tigers fans, this summer, why sit at home when you could sit at home? Fight, that is. Now is a great time to catch all the fun and excitement happening at every Detroit Tigers home game. You'll see plenty of homers by Pudge Rodriguez, Dimitri Young, Carlos Guillen, and all your favorite players. But a trip to Comerica Park means more than just baseball. While the Tigers are driving home runs, you could drive home in a brand new car during the Chevy Cobalt Drive One Home Giveaway, sponsored by your Detroit area Chevy dealers. Just buy a ticket to select Friday or Saturday night home games, and you could drive one out of here. Looking for a surefire hit? Hey, don't miss Friday and Saturday night fireworks, sponsored by Pepsi and Verizon Wireless. And with a weekend value pack, that's four tickets, four hot dogs, and four Pepsis for just $59. And you'll want to bring everyone from home. So for great giveaways like autographed balls, bobbleheads, collector cards, and jerseys, and for great baseball, this summer, catch a Tigers game. For tickets, call 248-25-TIGER or visit DetroitTigers.com and make Comerica Park your home away from home game.
Every Tuesday, get double shots of the best riff rock.
The way you want it.
Rock. See, I told you there was a rational explanation.
Two for Tuesday on 101 WRIF. Riff Rocks.
This is WRIF.com.
Now, Night Call is back on 101 WRIF Detroit. Here's your host, Peter Werbe.
Christopher Baker was on the show at least once, or maybe I've played his interview a couple of times before, so I think he's been on more than once. We'll ask him. The last time we spoke with Christopher Baker, it was about his travel journeys through Cuba. The book was called Mi Moto Fidel, and that is Motorcycling Through Castro's Cuba. And Chris Baker has just traveled everywhere, written travel books on any number of locations, particularly in the Caribbean. And he also has the definitive tour book on Cuba, published by Moon Books. And he's back with us, this time something near and dear to the hearts of us here in the Motor City, Detroit. It's called Cuba Classics, a celebration of vintage American automobiles. It's published by Interlink Books, and it's 200 pages of incredible vintage cars. Chris Baker, welcome back to the Peter Werby Show.
Thank you very much, Peter. It's a delight to be with you again.
Now, tell us, let's not make any assumptions. I always think that most people know that when you go to Cuba, automobile history stopped in essentially 1959 when the revolution occurred. Is that essentially true?
Well, there you go. That's the fact. It really did. The door slammed shut, and moreover, the Cuban government does not permit Cubans to buy contemporary cars. And so they've been clinging to these old relics, these wonderful old cars. And what was amazing for me during many years of traveling through Cuba is I'd be going down the road and I'd be passed by a Kaiser or a Hudson. All these wonderful cars that disappeared from the roadways of America years ago.
Now, we may be. In fact, I would look forward to repeating this interview because I'm anticipating it being as good as the last one where you chronicled your motorcycle tour through Cuba. Now, going through Cuba, getting all these photographs you told me before the before our interview over the last 10 years, and particularly in the last 3 years, we are coming up this weekend when this is being aired to something called where we bring in almost like a million people, and it's called it's right out of my brain, the cruise. We have this Motor City cruise, which is not how weird. I can't think of the name of it right now, when a million people are going to be coming into our town with these same kind of automobiles that are that you chronicle. Now, is there an attempt to make these look like the way the people do here in Detroit, to keep them in vintage shape?
Well, that really is wishful thinking. These are really beasts of burden, and it doesn't matter if you're talking about an old Cadillac or a Hudson or a Studebaker. These are everyday vehicles for Cubans, and so just keeping them running is the hardest part. There is no attempt nor even any possibility of being 100% true to the original. There are no replacement parts. Most of these cars are cobbled together and held together by wire and faith. But occasionally you'll see, very infrequently, you'll see a real gem. Many of the best models have actually been bought up by foreigners living there, the embassy staff, etc.
Now, if you have a 55 Chevy Impala hardtop, you're in Detroit and you're here this Saturday for the big event, you're very self-conscious. You're very aware that you've got this car that's half a century old. Is there that self-consciousness among the Cubans?
Well, not really, because these cars are such a day-to-day element of Cuban culture. It may surprise you to learn that about one in eight cars on the road in Cuba is a pre-revolutionary vehicle, many of them dating back to the 1920s or so. It's true to say that almost on any one day, certainly outside Havana, you may see a Model T Ford chugging down the road, and it's being used. these aren't roses to be cuddled on a Sunday, brought out of the garage on a Sunday. These are working vehicles. So they're just part of daily life. They're taken for granted. In fact, Cadillacs, pre-59 Cadillacs, are the backbone of the taxi fleet throughout the nation.
Really? Now, I was going to actually say something, but I probably ought to be a little wary, and we'll talk in a minute about what kind of penalties are involved for Americans traveling to Cuba, but a friend of mine was married recently in Cuba. I was going to mention the town, but I probably won't even do that. And there were he and his bride smiling, and in back was, I'm forgetting my car. It's probably like a 57 or actually they changed, like a 58 Chevy, and it was kind of dolled up with wedding kind of stuff. Are they used for special occasion? I mean, you did say they're the workhorses, but are they also recognized as a prestige item?
Yeah, there are two elements to that. One thing is that one of the wonderful things about being in Cuba is, of course, to see these cars working, passing down the road. But the best models, especially the convertibles, are hired out for, especially for weddings and for the 15th birthday celebrations of young girls, which is celebrated as their coming of age. And they're dolled up, and you know, they'll be hired out for $20, $30, $40 or so for the day. And they're an important source of income in a nation where trying to, you know, fighting for a good income is a hardship. So this is one of the great delights, especially on a Sunday.
Now, in your book, Cuba Classics, a celebration of vintage American automobiles. You must have had some favorites. What ones stand out? And is it just all visual, or was it the people connected with them?
Well, the book is not just a photographic celebration of the cars. It's really a story about the part that cars play in contemporary culture. And just as you would imagine here, people, many Cubans are totally into cars and totally into maintaining their old cars to the best of their abilities. Yes, I do have some of my favorite cars, but mostly they're to do with the people associated with them and some of the anecdotes that I had. If I may tell a brief one, I was on the seafront boulevard at dusk, this is in Havana, and crept up upon a 1959 Oldsmobile 88, beautiful vehicle. And I was down on my haunches taking photos with the sun shining, you know, the sun really low, red upon this green and white car. I thought I'd take some photos inside, and when I stood up to take photos inside, I found a couple on the front seat. And, they, you know, they were kissing, and they were lovers, and they smiled at me, waved. I took a photo, and about a month later, I went back to Cuba and gifted photos to the driver. When I arrived at his home, his wife answered the door. I realized I'd been photographing him and his mistress.
Oh. Well, you know, that that actually reminds me. I was thinking there's a Bob Seger song where they're talking about, he's talking about the back seats of these cars. Well, most modern American cars, and certainly European cars, there very little can go on in either the front or the back. However, in those big behemoths of the 50s, they, in fact, I think Khrushchev called them stinky sofas on wheels. are they in like popular lore the centers of amorous activity?
Well, certainly. I mean, Cuba is quite libertine in that way, and yes, they are. But mostly, particularly because there is such a shortage of housing, and so yes.
Yes, is the answer. All right, this is a family show, so we won't go any further than that. My guest is Christopher P. Baker, and he is the author of Cuba Classics from Interlink Books, just published. And you can go to cuba-automobiles.com, cuba-automobiles.com. I'll have that on my website as well. And we're talking about the cars that never, they kind of frozen in amber after the 1959 Cuban Revolution. But there's got to be, when you said that's just American cars, so what do they have, like Russian Ladas and all those kind of clunkers that never worked real well?
Yes, those are there, and if and hopefully soon when Cuba is opened up to American travelers are going to be in for a shock, because the Mercedes are there, the modern Volvos are there, the modern Japanese automobiles are there. They've been importing cars since the revolution from Europe. Most of those cars, the vast, vast majority, of course, are owned by the Cuban government. Modern Mercedes are actually a backbone of the tourist taxi fleet. Hmm. As are Peugeot and Renaults from France. But for about 20 or 30 years, of course, most of the cars that were imported between the revolution and the fall of the Soviet Union were Ladas. You know, they're all pretty much all lemons, but they are by far the most numerous vehicle in Cuba, and they're gifted out by or leased out by the Cuban government to workers, to party officials, etc. But I think every Cuban secretly wishes to have a pre-1959, at least a working model. The mid-50s Chevys are really particularly sought after.
Just like here.
Yeah, they're considered the most reliable. And, of course, the Studebakers, which are so numerous, it's incredible.
Really?
Studebakers are there. But they're in Cuba, they're referred to as Studi no gracias for no thank you.
Oh.
Because they're not considered to be the most reliable vehicle.
Do they have those? I used to have one of those low-slung Raymond Loewy design two-door ones that looked like were the predecessor of those Super Hawks.
Mm-hmm. They're there.
Wow. That's awesome.
You name me an American model, and I can swear it'll be there. I think the only model that I've not seen is in 1957, Cadillac made an Eldorado Brougham. There were only about 700 of them made.
Wow.
I've been looking for one. I can't find one.
How about Nash Ramblers, those little two-seaters?
Plenty. And the funny thing is, before I conceived doing this book, of course, I was working on another books in Cuba and photographing, and of course, I love American cars, so I was photographing these cars, but I didn't photograph any Nashes because I didn't consider them particularly an attractive vehicle. And that was the case for many other vehicles that I passed in Cuba. And it was only later when I came to research this book and began, because I'm English and I don't know my American car models, or at least didn't until researching this book. But as soon as I started to research, I realized that I'd failed to photograph some very rare vehicles in Cuba. And then I made up for it by photographing some Nashes.
Did you say, I forgot, what class of people have the older cars? Is it... dumb old me. I mean, I thought that these were like the only cars. Why I wouldn't have figured it out that there were cars from other countries is beyond me. But who has the old vintage cars? Is it the middle class or the poor or who?
Well, there's really no such thing as, you know, the middle class as such anymore. There are certainly people who are favored, such as the communist bureaucrats. But, you know, these cars are sprinkled throughout society. Of course, many, many people who did not leave after the revolution, who were middle class or upper class, they kept their cars. A lot of those cars were left behind by people who fled Cuba for Miami, and those cars were seized, and they were either seized by people who moved into Havana and just as opportunists took the vehicles, or they were taken by the Cuban government and handed out, gifted, if you will, to various other individuals. So all walks of society.
Mm-hmm. Chris Baker, you told me before the show as well that your book Cuba Classics is just part one of a trilogy you're doing on the second one, which I think of as very Cuban. I never thought about the third, but tell us about the one about baseball.
Well, this coffee table book, which is what Cuba Classics is, will be a trilogy of very similar books that is a photographic celebration of baseball within Cuban culture. I'm just beginning work on that, just as I'm beginning work on a similar book on the dogs of Cuba, because dogs are a very important part of Cuban culture also. So I want to focus on the three things that I think Americans have an affinity for, a passion and a love for. Old cars, baseball, and dogs fits that bill, but also themes that are very important within Cuban society.
Well, of course, Cuban baseball players are legendary. In fact, maybe since you're pretty savvy on Cuba stuff, I read a novel about 3 or 4 years ago that featured the young Fidel Castro as a pitcher. Was an American down there? Does that ring any bells?
It rings a lot of bells. In fact, there's actually more of a misconception that he tried out for the Washington Senators. From my research recently, it seems that was not the case. That is not to dismiss Fidel as not having come up to par, if you will, as a baseball player. He was an exceptionally good pitcher and an extremely gifted all-round sports figure in his youth. In fact, he won the Cuban National Championship as the athlete of the year when he was about, 18 or 19 or so.
Yeah, actually, in the novel I read, that figures in it, a tryout with the old Washington Senators. By the way, I just, all I got to do is wait. My mother always used to say, if anything's important, when you say you can't remember something, she says, if it was important, you'll remember. It's the Woodward Dream Cruise. Why in the world that didn't pop to my mind, since this is going to dominate for, you know, a week ahead with all these old cars. Many of which are now residing in Cuba, chronicled in the book Cuba Classics, Celebration of Vintage American Automobiles. My guest on the Peter Werby Show, Christopher Baker, the author. Dogs?
I'll tell you how it happened. I was in Cuba for one day. I'd gone to a conference in Mexico vis-a-vis Cuba and U.S. relations, and I went into Cuba for the day and actually had an interview with Fidel. But I was with an NBC film crew during the afternoon, and we were walking through the streets of Havana, and the cameraman pointed his camera at a mutt, just a mutt lazing in the sun, and the dog looked, saw the camera, and rolled on its back and spread all four legs and hemmed for the camera. I swear that the entire street roared with laughter.
Really?
And I thought back to, there's a series of very successful books on the cats of Greece. There are 10 coffee table books by photographer called Hans Sylvester on the theme of cats in Greece, and do very, very well. And at that moment, I realized that in my stock photography, I've got some very wonderful photos of dogs. And dogs are a very important part of Cuban society. I'm going back in November for the International Dog Show in Havana.
Really?
So a lot of the dogs, a lot of families, even though they're hard-pressed to put food on the table, life isn't too easy, nonetheless love their dogs, and every pedigree of dog you can imagine exists in Cuba. But the second side is that about 50% of the dogs in Cuba are street dogs, and most of those, and many of those dogs, were put out on the streets after the collapse of the Soviet Union, particularly 1992-93 were terrible years for Cuba and the Cuban people. Malnutrition returned. It was very difficult to feed oneself. And so they put the dogs out on the street because they couldn't keep them alive. They ate the cats. Cats disappeared from the streets of Cuba, but nobody could bear to eat their dogs. So these delightful creatures are a very important part of Cuban society. Cubans love dogs and treat them very, very well.
Now, as you were saying, and we can tell by this interview, Chris, that you've been to Cuba any number of times. I loved your I'm looking at a travel book. Is that a best travel adventure? Let's call it Mi Moto Fidel, where you traveled through this island. What did that I remember? Let me see if I remember my lessons from reading your moon travel guide on Cuba. It's 700 miles long. How am I doing?
A little bit more, but not, you know, you're in the ballpark.
Okay, and you drove your motorcycle 5,000 miles.
Actually, 7,000 miles.
Oh, man. Yeah. Through Cuba, collecting the material for the travel book.
Exactly.
Well, you've been in the United States for, you said, about 20 years. I say, every time I talk to you, your English accent diminishes more. You're going to be saying France and chance pretty soon.
Well, that's because I'm in California on the West Coast. Maybe if I were closer to England on the East Coast, I wouldn't be losing it.
Now, are you an American citizen?
I am these days, yes.
So how can you go to Cuba when most other people can't?
I'm a full-time professional journalist, accredited journalist, and go for research reasons. That's basically it.
Mm-hmm. Now, what about someone like myself who does interviews like this, that does a lot of news reporting? Can I just hop on a plane and
yes, you can. There are certain categories. There are two categories of journalists, and those who are freelancers who have a very questionable status as full-timers would certainly have to apply for what's called a specific license from the U.S. Treasury Department to go to spend money in Cuba. There's no restriction on travel per se. It's on trading.
Spending money. But as I remember from your book, I could travel under what's called a general license?
You could, because you are employed by an accredited broadcasting entity. So, yes, you could go under a general license. Mm. Having said that, the regulations change frequently, and I would point you to the Treasury Department, point anybody to the Treasury Department's website to look up the latest, because certainly in late June, there were some very, very significant changes came out of the Bush administration that changed the regulations as to who can go to Cuba and under what conditions.
Yeah, and they tightened it up. Actually.
Very much so.
Right. Now, as it stands, people that are eight or 9 miles south of me in Windsor can just get on a plane and fly directly to Holguín in the eastern sector of Cuba. Yet if we're just a mile south of that and on the Detroit side, you're subject to fines now. I think they've made them huge, haven't they?
Well, the fines themselves have not changed. What has changed is that there was never any prosecutions, never have been any prosecutions of anybody spending money illegally in Cuba. That has changed in that they nominated three judges to oversee the backlog of cases of people who have been accused of spending money illegally in Cuba. So that's changed, but also they are definitely beginning to, or have begun to, police more to try and identify individuals who are going to Cuba illegally. It's absolutely ridiculous, given that I think there are about 20 staff members in the U.S. Treasury Department whose job it is to try and impose these sanctions on travel to Cuba, but only three of those staffers trying to trace monies of Al-Qaeda internationally, etc. It's absolutely ludicrous. But nothing has ever been sane between U.S.-Cuba relations for four decades.
Now, I must know a minimum of 20 people that have been to Cuba, and they've never had a knock on the door, never got a letter. Are they home free, or could they be in danger of getting a fine?
Well, it depends. I mean, the laws are on the books, and if one has been identified as having gone to Cuba and spent money there, there's always a possibility that, it might be 5 years ago, but the knock may come on the door. But I think the chances of that are very, very minimal indeed.
Mm-hmm. Now, you talked about at least indicated pretty early in our interview, that when things got back to normal, some people fear a return to normalcy, I guess it is, Cuba will become sort of just like Aruba, the way some of these little enclaves for Canadian and European tourists are, that right now that Cuba has a spirit and a quality to it that could quickly be destroyed if the United States and Cuba weren't at odds.
Well, that's certainly true. If you've read me Motto Fidel, you certainly know that I have two minds as to the Cuban government. I acknowledge the wonderful things that the Castro government has done without being misled as to the fact that it's been an intensely destructive process and caused immense hardship and continues to do so for a lot of people, not least in individual freedoms. But the one thing, to take up your particular point there, the one thing that is so notable and so distinct and individual about Cuba is that the last four decades of America being held at arm's length has enabled Cuba not only to preserve a traditional culture, but also to really sponsor traditional culture. And if you go to an island close by, Puerto Rico, for example, whilst there's a lot of Puerto Rican culture still alive, nonetheless, you know very well that you're in an offshoot of America, mainland America. And I fear that very quickly that will happen. There are no McDonald's in Cuba right now. Mm. There's actually one on Guantanamo Naval Base. But there are no mainstream, there's no KFC, Walmart, etc. That is already beginning to change as Cuban government initiates its Cuban equivalents of those entities. But really what I'm trying to say is that as soon as the embargo is lifted, and that's assuming that there's a radical change in government, and that's not a given that will happen, then there will be wholesale change because the corporations, the big corporations, see a population of 11 million people that's virginal in the sense of business opportunity.
Any sense of what Cuba would look like after Castro is gone, assuming he dies a natural death? Will communism go on, or will that be the signal for the unraveling?
Well, I personally believe there will be an unraveling. I think there's an inevitability to it, but it may be a slow process. His brother, Raul, younger brother, who is a dedicated communist, is number two in line, and they have certainly prepared themselves very well for Fidel's passing. I think the key is what will happen in Washington. There will certainly be a lot of turmoil within Cuba because 50% of the population or so do support at least some elements of the current situation there. 50% are dying for change and freedom. What the Cuban-Miamian, Cuban-American elite do in Miami and what Washington does to support them, I think, is critical to whether Raul Castro will be able to consolidate his hold. So very, very difficult question to answer.
Mm-hmm. Well, the book, and a handsome one it is, filled with photographs of cars that would just make all of us tingle on a dream cruise weekend here in Detroit. The book is called Cuba Classics, a celebration of vintage American automobiles. It's published by Interlink Books. You can go to Cuba-automobiles.com. And what about, should people check out this travelguidebooks.com? Is that going to go directly to you, or do you have to have...
That is actually my personal website.
Okay. And if you're traveling somewhere, Chris Baker's probably been there, particularly in the Caribbean, so you might want to check that out. As usual, Chris Baker, thanks for joining me on the Peter Werbe Show.
Peter, it's a great pleasure to be with you again. I look forward to another opportunity soon.
WRIF.com.
And now, a word from the Riff Legal Eagles. Unless otherwise stated, all entrants for WRIF contests must be at least 18 years of age and a legal resident of the United States. A household is eligible to win one contest per 30 days, every 6 months, for prizes valued at $600 or higher. Greater Media Detroit and its affiliates, promotional sponsors, advertising and promotional agencies, and other radio and television stations in the Detroit ADI are not eligible to participate. One entry per person. No purchase or other consideration is necessary to participate in the contest. Void where prohibited. Prizes are non-transferable or redeemable for cash. 101 WRIF reserves the right to substitute any price for one of equal or greater value. By participating in the contest, contestants consent to the broadcast and or publication of their name, voice, face, and or likeness without compensation. Participants listening online at www.wrif.com may receive audio that is delayed by as much as 60 seconds later than the over-the-air transmission, which could potentially affect chances of winning. General contest rules are available online at www.wrif.com or during regular business hours at the WRIF Studios, 1 Radio Plaza, Detroit, Michigan, 48220.
Bill Bonds with a commercial. If you're near or farsighted and you want to throw away those glasses forever, I know a doctor you should see. Dr. Escombati. Phone number 1-877. Then the letters U-S-E-E-M-O-R-E. 1-877. You see more. The equipment, the finest high-tech equipment ever made. Price $999 per eye. So don't fall for those $200 prices you hear being tossed around on the radio. Cows don't fly. Neither do those prices, unless your daddy is an eye doctor and you're getting a freebie. Dr. S. Combati, no doctor we know of has a better success rate. Procedure is fast, safe, cost $999 per eye. Virtually painless, you're in and out, maybe 40 minutes. Procedure itself, maybe 5. When it's over, you'll want to kiss your glasses goodbye and hug the doctor. Or maybe you guys will just want to give him a hi-fi. Shake hands with them, walk away, and see a whole new world. See ya.
Anglers, get ready to cast your line for big money. The OSI Pro Series WRIF Great Lakes Fishing Championship Series is underway, and there's still time to enter to win the $1,500 Series Championship. Sign up now for the Fast Championship going out of Lake Erie Metro Park on July 30th. Slots will fill up fast, so get your entry in now. Compete for thousands of dollars in cash and prizes, including the DMF Bait Award for the kid under 16 landing the largest fish on live bait. It's all going to be given away to the best fishing team in town, so sign up now by calling 248-591-6841 or go to WRIF.com for an entry form. There will be fun for everyone at the post-event party at Big Al Sports Grill, so call 248-591-6841 to become the OSI Pro Series WRIF Great Lakes Fishing Series Champion. Call 248-591-6841 today. Brought to you by OSI Pro Series, the DMF Bait Company, Big Al Sports Grill, and 101 WRIF.
Every day, employers search for people skilled in today's technology. Are you ready for a change to a new career? Make a difference for yourself by calling the ITT Technical Institutes at 1-800-396-6622. Find out how an ITT Tech can help you prepare for a career in electronics, information technology, or drafting and design. Nationwide, thousands have launched technical careers after graduating from an ITT Tech. Classes meet just a few times a week to help you balance school and your job. Financial aid is available.
Hey, this is Rob Zombie, and you're rocking with 101 WRIF, number one in the morning and number one for rock.